Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. If we could settle down a little bit to have a little bit of instruction for the audience, particularly our witnesses. Senate File 2818 is the only item on our agenda. It's my understanding that the companion bill in the House to this bill was heard last night, and that testimony lasted for 4 hours. That will not happen in this committee today. And our goal is to not meet tonight. So we are going to provide adequate testimony and adequate opportunity for all parties to speak on this issue. However, we are not going to be repetitious. And if you have written remarks that are pre-written and are repetitious of what has already been said to a good degree, I'm going to cut you off. I'm going to cut you off because we don't have that much time. We're not going to spend 4 hours on this hearing, particularly since this bill has to go to several other committees as well. And deadlines are short. We just don't have that type of capability, at least on this bill. So, with that, Senator Anderson, Senate File 2818.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Boy, it's really noisy out there. If you could keep the door shut, please. Thank you. Sorry. You won't be able to hear me. Can you hear me all right, or do I need to move this a little closer?
I'll do that. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I wanted to start by saying what you just said, which is that this bill does have a large number of committees to visit before any bill would emerge on the Senate floor. And so my request to the committee would be that you take me at my word that I intend to work with all affected parties on this bill as we move forward and to try to find consensus if possible and certainly compromise. And so I think it's really important just to say that right off the bat, because I know there's a lot of people sitting here ready to come in with their guns a-blazing, and I want to say let's talk and let's see if we can get something good done together that will move us forward. And I think there is always a possibility of finding that common ground. So I'm really committed to that.
And I think we need to realize we go to different committees because a bill covers different topics. We're going to talk about the environmental policy of this bill. In other committees, we will talk about the energy policy related to this bill. In others, potentially transportation. Not this one.
This bill is going to transportation.
Oh, okay, this one.
Yes.
And potentially a jobs committee. So for those who are testifying, please understand that we're primarily interested in environmental policy.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we haven't had a lot of time in this committee to talk about the concept of a cap and trade. So I think it's really great that you've set aside time. And I want to spend a few minutes, if I could, just talking about why I think the idea of a cap and trade matters and how I would explain its importance to the state of Minnesota. So let me just start there. Just by way of background, we all know last year when we passed the Next Generation Energy Act, authored by Senator Pretner Solon, and it passed with an overwhelming majority in the House and Senate, that we set by law goals for the state of Minnesota to reduce our global warming emissions. Those goals are quite ambitious. Those are for 15% reduction by 2015, 30% reduction by 2025, and 80% reduction by mid-century, by 2050. And we pick those numbers for a very good reason. It's because the scientists tell us that's what we have to do, that's what the whole world has to do, but that's what Minnesota should do as our part to stop dangerous levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from creating massive changes that would be destructive to our planet, our habitat, and our human way of life and our quality of life. And so we have goals in place. We also last year, as you know, passed very strong bills relating to the electricity sector to move us towards more efficiency and renewables. But the cap and trade idea goes far beyond electricity. And what it does is looks at the whole state and all the sectors across the state. And that's why we have a lot of committees to visit, because we have to talk about different sectors, transportation, buildings, large industrial emitters, all of us in our homes, all those contributions to greenhouse gases need to be at the table to reach those goals that we as a state are committed to reaching. So a cap essentially is a cap. In plain English, it just sets a limit on emissions across the state. And the reason you put the trading element into it is because then you have a market-based policy that makes it more flexible, more efficient, and less costly. Some sectors, some companies perhaps that are big emitters, or some sectors of the economy will be able to reduce their emissions more cheaply and more easily than others. And with a trading system in place, you allow those companies or industries or sectors that are able to really reduce their emissions to be able to do that and to sell their allowance, their permit to emit, and to make money doing that. And those that can't reduce their emissions as easily can buy those. So you have a market-based approach that allows some give and take across, under that overall umbrella of what the emissions have to be in our state. So you set a limit based on where we're at right now, and then it gradually ratchets down a percent or two every year to get to those goals, starting with 15% by 2015. So the first thing that you have to do to set a cap is to have a system whereby anyone who emits these greenhouse gases, these global warming emissions, has to have an allowance or a permit. I guess we call them allowances in this bill. But it's basically permission to emit, legal permission. Right now, there's not really any legal or financial penalty in our marketplace for emitting those global warming gases. You can do it for free. And we need to set this cap so that we put a price on that, because what you're doing is taking away the benefit that we all have of a livable planet and an atmosphere that's clean and unpolluted. And there needs to be a price on emitting that carbon. The example of the acid rain cap and trade, I'm sure will come up from some of the experts who can testify, that's where a cap and trade has been used in the United States, and it was an incredible success. It was crafted to try to stop acid rain emissions, and it worked in exactly the way that I hope I've described, where there was a limit set, and then companies were able to trade back and forth so that they all had an incentive to reduce emissions that were targeted, and they did it at a lower cost and faster than anyone even predicted using that system. So it's a proven economic tool that works with a market-based economy like ours to reach our policy goals of reducing emissions with the lowest cost and the least dislocation. So that's kind of why I think we need a cap, how a cap and trade would work as a framework. But I want to talk a little bit about where we're at. You know, I don't think we should be arguing at this point, I hope, about whether we're going to have a cap and trade, because it's pretty much the fact that that train has left the station. And I'll tell you why, a few reasons. One is that the law that passed last year, Senator Prettner-Solin's law, also said that by 2009, we have to have a law like that in place. And if we don't, a moratorium will take place on new large power plants that emit carbon dioxide. So we have a lot of teeth set into that law to say that by 2009, we've already set that as a deadline for our state to act. Secondly, the governor's climate change advisory group, the MCAG, has recommended a cap and trade, a regional cap and trade, and that Minnesota participate in that. And then, of course, the governor himself has helped to negotiate a regional agreement with six other Midwestern states and the province of Manitoba that they've signed off on that says we will have a regional cap and trade in the Midwestern states, a multi-sector cap and trade that goes beyond electricity and covers the multiple sectors of the economy. That is moving forward. Now, that process is set up so that between now and next November, November of 2008, a model rule will be negotiated among those six governors and Manitoba to put together the details, what it would look like, what the rules of the game would be for this Midwest regional cap and trade. And that's part of why we introduced this bill, because I very strongly support what the governor is doing there. I support the process of putting together a Midwest cap and trade, and I want us to play a part in that. We're legislators. We're elected to represent the entire state of Minnesota, all of us together, all 67 senators, and I think it's critically important that we have a voice in that process. Now, we're not governors. We can't do what the governor does and do those state-level negotiations, but we are going, as legislators, to have a pivotal role in putting together the final plan and putting it into paper, you know, putting it on paper and passing the laws that will implement a final cap and trade across the Midwest. And so I think it's really important that we put some principles in place about how we'd like to see that move forward. And that's what this bill is about. This bill doesn't actually launch a cap and trade program. It's intended to just set forth principles that we think are important, that we'd like the governor to take with him when he goes to do these negotiations. So we can talk about that more when we get into the bill itself. One more thing about the cap and trade leaving the station, that train leaving the station. As you all know, all three of the major presidential candidates are on record as supporting a national cap and trade program. So we know that it's coming nationally. We just don't know how long it will take. And we can argue about whether it's better to do it in the Midwest or do it nationally. But I would argue, and a lot of experts agree, that we will be best positioned if we act sooner rather than wait. And the reason is, number one, if we really hash out how this would work best for Minnesota, then we are at an advantage when we get to that larger agreement that will be hammered out in Washington. We will be at the table. This is our chance for Minnesotans, legislators, and all the interest groups to have a chance to have a voice in putting together a plan that really works for our state and maximizes our ability to have economic benefit in this new green economy, in this new carbon-constrained world. You know, when Governor Pawlenty and six other governors are sitting down at the table and negotiating, not too many of us are going to have a voice there personally as legislators. And certainly when the national process is negotiated, we will not have much of a voice. We'll be one of 50 states. And so I think this is an opportunity for us to kind of, as hard as this work is, to grapple with the difficult decisions about how to do it in a way that is most beneficial for us, given our circumstances as this great state that we live in. So I would say that a basic assumption is that it's not if we're going to have a cap and trade, it's more when and how we're going to do it. So I hope we can start with that assumption. Let's see. I've already went way past my notes here. Okay, so just to talk about some of the major principles that I think we ought to, that I would propose, representing a lot of different organizations that will come and speak in support of this proposal, that I would like to see as Minnesota principles that would inform this regional process. Now, I know we're going to have a lot of discussion about what those principles should be and what people think is right for Minnesota, and that's what we should have debate about. But the first really important principle is about auctioning allowances. There's, you know, we talked about how you have to have an allowance under this regime, which we know is going to come in the next, sooner or later. You have to have an allowance to be able to emit pollution, global warming pollution, or carbon dioxide. The question is, do you give that allowance for free, or do you sell it to those who emit pollution or global warming emissions? Or is there some, you know, happy medium? This bill calls for 100% of those allowances to be auctioned off, to be sold for a price, and the money to be used for the broadest possible public benefit. And I think there's some good, solid public policy reasons to do that, as well as economic reasons to do that. So let me just go through that, and I'll try not to take too long so that the testifiers can, who are the real experts, can talk about this. Again, we need to, the reason why you sell, you need to sell these. We're trying to put a cost on carbon, to attach a cost to pumping that into the atmosphere. Right now, it's free to pollute the atmosphere, so there's no incentive to change. If you put a cost to that, you create a very strong incentive to try to reduce your emissions as quickly as possible. And that's what we want to have happen with a cap system in order to meet those goals that we've all supported. Sir Nicholas Stern, who was the former chief economist of the World Bank, said that he called the lack of carbon regulation and the world's biggest market failure. Some have called it capitalism's biggest market failure. We don't, under the system we have now, we don't pay the cost of the damage we create across the world by emitting global warming gases. And if you don't charge for those allowances, you're subsidizing that pollution around the world. So I believe you need to give incentives to those who emit to reduce emissions, to use the market to drive the right results. Let me just give one example. If you have Industry A and Industry B, and one of them has done a really good job of reducing their emissions, then when it comes time to give away allowances, the one that hasn't done such a good job is going to need a lot more allowances because they emit a lot more. And then they're going to have something that's of value that they can sell. And if they reduce their emissions, they can make a lot of money from that. Whereas the company that's already reduced dramatically, or the industry that has, is not going to get that benefit. So it's not really fair. If you give away the allowances to both of them, then the company that, or the industry that's done the most does not get rewarded, and the one that hasn't gets rewarded for polluting. So in the European Union, they did give away allowances, and they found that prices went up for consumers, and there was no way to provide any public benefit because there was no system in place for revenue to try to sort of cushion that impact. The other big reason for charging for these allowances is the basic fairness, and I've talked about that a little bit. The atmosphere and the air is really a public good. It belongs to all of us. It belongs to all living things on the planet, I would argue, and it's a precious natural resource, and I believe there should be a cost to damage or pollute that. It's the basic polluter pays principle that we've always tried to follow in this committee. So in this bill, we set up a climate trust fund, and those proceeds would come in to go to the public benefit, and they would help accelerate the transition to a green economy, a successful green economy, because if we had funds, we could provide broad public benefits so people could be able to still pay their energy costs, but also really emphasize helping individuals reduce their energy consumption, helping the industries that are the hardest hit reduce their energy consumption and their costs as well. So you could target the benefit as well as in a way that would have more impact than just having a cap where you just give away the allocations. Briefly, other issues that are in the bill, the sectors that are covered, it's really important that it's broad, but what we cover generally is a fairly broad brush across the major sectors that emit those global warming gases in Minnesota. Besides the electricity sector, it's natural gas, it's transportation, it's buildings and large industrial emitters. We did not include forestry or agriculture in the covered sectors, and the main reason for that is at this point in time, it's difficult to measure those emissions that are coming from those industries, and it's difficult to measure reductions. So instead, we focus our efforts in trying to provide benefit, some of the benefit funds back to agriculture and forestry to try to encourage and incentivize practices that will reduce emissions in those sectors. We don't have offsets permitted in this bill because of the difficulty of ensuring that they are real, additional, verifiable, enforceable, and permanent. And so that's something that we need to figure out. No safety valves. In other words, you don't want the caps to go up because then you undermine your ability to reach your goals. And then finally, we have two studies in the bill. And in my committee, it'll be my job to see if I can find a very small amount of money to be able to fund these studies that are critically important. One is to think about and figure out, get some expert analysis of how, when there is an auction of allocations or of allowances, if there's an auction of allowances, how do you collect the money? How much? And how is that governed? How is that money used? Because it's really important that you have a transparent and trustworthy system that is going to be used for the purposes intended, and that we set that up from the get-go. Secondly, the second study would be to focus on the economics of this. Look at the costs and the benefits, the economic impacts to different industries, the economic impacts to everyone across the board in Minnesota, the impacts to individuals, and to figure out how you can help to overcome negatives and enhance positive impacts. For example, how to specifically focus on very energy-intensive industries that might be subject to competition from outside of the capped region. That's an issue for a national cap and trade, just like it is for a regional one. Let's see. Just a couple more comments. On the economic impact, I think you'll hear from the testifiers about what the impact of having auctions would be. And remember, one thing that the MCAG did conclude, the Climate Change Advisory Group put together a comprehensive list of recommendations. We've heard about it in the Energy Committee that would get us to those goals of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And they tried to do a cost-benefit analysis for each one of those steps that they recommended. And overall, their recommendation says if we do every one of their recommended steps, pass those, implement those, and move forward, we will not only meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals, meet our global warming reduction goals in Minnesota, but we'll save the state $9 billion. So there's some good evidence out there that we can do this in a way that's economically beneficial for our state, and that's something we're going to have to really explore in detail. I have a handout, that comes from the McKinsey Global Institute, a well-regarded international economic firm that reports that you could get half the cuts worldwide that you need to meet those emission reduction goals in a way that actually saves money, that's actually a net profit to those who invest in it. The amount of energy efficiency worldwide that could be gained from a large investment would actually return far more than was invested. And you could do that. So you could do it at a net profit and meet half of our goals. And they identified, this was an international study, and they identified some of the most inefficient sectors. They talk about energy productivity, how much energy you use. And they identified China's industries, heavy industry in China, as the most inefficient sector and second most inefficient sector. Residential housing in the United States. And that really, it's kind of good and bad. I mean, the bad news is it's a problem. And I always talk about my house as an example. I live in an old house in St. Paul. I've got leaky windows, leaky walls. I need a new efficient furnace. All that stuff costs a lot of money on a legislator's salary. And there are thousands and thousands of people just like me in Minnesota that really would have a hard time affording those improvements that they need to make their house energy efficient and more comfortable and to reduce their energy bills and their energy consumption. But a lot of us would really like to do it. And if we got a little more help to get there, if we could have government policies that would help drive those changes, we could reduce our energy consumption dramatically, improve our quality of life, and get every single Minnesotan involved in that important job. So they focus on not just poorly insulated homes, but also, large poorly insulated homes equipped with a range of appliances that are often inefficient or poorly used, and, appliances that don't turn off automatically, et cetera. So Let me just conclude again by saying that I really want to pass a bill this year that the legislature can support and that establishes what our position is. But again, I'm extremely committed to working with everybody to try to find some common ground on this. And I think that can be done because we know that it's moving forward. The cap and trade is moving forward, and we want to be part of the solution. That's why we call this the Green Solutions Act. And I think that the benefits to Minnesota can be absolutely enormous if we do this right. And so I look forward to the discussion. That I'll invite my witnesses to come to the table. I've got Reverend Mark Peters, J. Drake Hamilton, and then I guess when they're done, we'll bring up the next two.
Welcome to the committee. Who would like to go first?
I'd appreciate if I could go first. My name is Senator Chaudhry and members of the committee. My name is Mark Peters. I've been executive director of Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota for 13 years now, and from this meeting I'm going to another one talking about the Legislative Commission to End Poverty with a lot of faith leaders. This is one of the issues that we have had a great deal of attention to in recent years. Actually, in the 20 years that our office has been in existence, Creation Care has been core to our mission statement. Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota is a partner ministry of all six Minnesota synods statewide, working with all six Minnesota bishops. There are 1,200 ELCA congregations in Minnesota, about 800,000 baptized Lutherans. Global warming is a religious and it is a moral issue, and I'd like to begin with a word of thanks to you, to all of you here, for your historic actions that shaped the legislation last year. And now comes the hard part, and that's implementation. As I would call it, practicing what we preach. What scientists say is needed to avert this global crisis. The ELCA social statement on caring for creation, called Vision, Hope, and Justice, it passed overwhelmingly at a national churchwide assembly, spoke of the current crisis, and it spoke of it through a 1993 lens. This is when it passed, and it's been revisited on 10-year basis. I was just in Chicago looking at it as a whole church at this statement. It said, the earth is a planet of beauty and abundance. The earth system is wonderfully intricate and incredibly complex, but today living creatures and the air, soil, and water that support them face unprecedented threats. Many threats are global. Most stem directly from human activity. Our current practices may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner we know. When I testified last year on a number of bills related to this, I said that over half of the phone calls to our office, which is right across the street from the Capitol, are on this issue. Ingrid Vick, thankfully, who's here today, is a full-time congregation creation care coordinator for our office working around the state, and I'd like to speak to some of the things we collectively have been working to address. We sponsor, and I'll have this handout here just so you can see the flyer, 8 global warming solutions events. Jay was a part of all of those with Fresh Energy, the Will Steger Foundation. Will Steger has generously contributed his time to work with faith communities in this regard. Let me just go through where these events were very quickly.
Mr. Peters,
yes.
I'd prefer it if we could concentrate on the bill that we've got before us and tell us why you support the bill.
Okay. Well, specifically, these events generated hundreds of postcards to legislators, specifically urging them to address this issue this coming session, to not wait.
Very good. Thank you.
And these events were large. The bishops, I want to speak to the scope of congregational involvement around the state on this particular issue. There were 450 people in New Ulm. The bishops spoke. 600 in Lakeville, 500 in Duluth, 550 in Sauk Rapids, 200 in Albert Lea, 900 in Rochester, 1,000 people in Moorhead, which drew from a 100-mile radius from that area, and 350 people in Mankato. The bishops, each of the bishops spoke at all these events about the urgency and this is a point I want to get across, of dealing with this now and not waiting. We also did a ministerium in Minneapolis Area Synod, and I will share with you a resolution, but I just want to speak to the resolved. They call for St. Paul separately and Minneapolis Area Synod to urge their congregations, their bishop, and their synod to address the urgency of this issue through public policy advocacy. That's why I'm here today. Finally, this is not just this year. We had events in the last couple of years. We had 1,000 people in Matamidi with Will Steger, 1,000 people in Eden Prairie. These are large events. The bishop spoke, and this is a very core issue. I'd like to conclude with these words. Well, with this this question, how many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb? Change? Or it's never been done that way before? In 1995, when I started working with Lutheran Coalition, styrofoam and recycling were the buzzwords. It is totally transformed now. Changing light bulbs is a core part of what congregations see as part of their mission now, part of their stewardship. Changing light bulbs is significant, but it is not sufficient to address the scope of the issue. Congregations are busier now than ever practicing what they preach, reducing their carbon footprint. Creation care teams are being established. They're doing energy audits, upgrading furnaces, insulation, carpooling. Again, all of these are significant but not sufficient. And this gets to my point. The congregations are making the faith and the climate change connection. But there is a growing tipping point, I would say, realization that these problems are systemic. The scale and the scope of the required multi-sector transformation needed requires policy solutions. You all responded last year by stepping up to the plate, and thanks are due for that historic action. And I am hopeful now as never before. In fact, during the season of Lent, you know, we like to say the Nelson Mandela words, we are prisoners of hope, that policy is significant, but it is not sufficient. Change happens through thoughtful implementation guided by core principles and values. You now have the opportunity to weigh in with those principles to guide this process going forward. And there is a cost to not acting and to waiting. And I'd like to finish with one brief quote, and then I'm done. When Martin Luther, this is from the Social Statement on Caring for Creation, was asked what he would do if the world were to end tomorrow, he reportedly answered, "I would plant an apple tree today." The social statement concludes with, "When we face today's crisis, we do not despair, we act. I urge your action today to move this bill forward and state your principles." Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is J. Drake Hamilton. I'm here today representing Fresh Energy. I serve Fresh Energy as our science policy director, and I run our Global Warming Solutions Program, which I've done since 1995. I'm also here today as a representative and a voice for the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, or MEP, which, as you probably know, is a collective of 80 conservation groups and environmental organizations with a collective membership of over 500,000 Minnesotans in every district of the state. Each year, MEP selects a priority or collaborative agenda at the legislature, issues where they believe now is the time to weigh in, now is the time for the legislature and the governor to take action, where there's considerable public support for the issue and where there's a very great need to take the next set of steps forward. Senate File 2818, the Green Solutions Act, is just such a bill, and we heartily endorse its passage. What's changed since 2007 when this legislature passed the Next Generation Energy Act is a couple of things. First of all, the world scientists have weighed in and said, yes, indeed, global warming is unequivocal everywhere in the world, and that most of the changes we've seen are on top of the natural variability. Most of the changes are being caused by human choices and activities. For me, that means there is a responsibility and an opportunity to make better choices. For this committee, the type of changes that Minnesota scientists predict that would impact our environment and resources include more warming to the extent of perhaps an additional 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit in Minnesota in the next century, drying of the soils, great changes in the forests,
in water availability in agricultural and oil soils, drying of the prairie pothole regions, and very great risks to some of the iconic wildlife species in Minnesota, including moose, loons, trout, and walleye, even as far south as Lake Pepin. The DNR is already seeing heat stress in our walleye. So there's a lot to lose. And any industry in Minnesota that depends on predictable weather, that depends on soil moisture, that depends on a certain temperature range in the summertime and in the wintertime, is also vulnerable to these changes. It used to be that the scientists, when they talked about global warming leading to more extreme weather, we kind of left it at that. But it has really become obvious in Minnesota and almost everywhere on Earth that the extreme weather events that we're seeing more of, the heavy downpours of 1 and 2 inch rainfalls and more, are really expensive weather, and that's what we're trying to forestall. The other thing that has changed is that now we have very good documentation in Minnesota from the Pollution Control Agency and verified by the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, of which I was appointed one of 55 or 56 members by the governor. We have an inventory of emissions in Minnesota. And so we know that the baseline you're working from to try to get the reductions of 15% by 2015, et cetera, in the Next Generation Energy Act, the baseline is 2005. And the baseline emissions in Minnesota were 155 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, 155 million metric tons. The projection is, under business as usual, if we don't act, those emissions rise to more than 197 million metric tons by 2025. So exactly at the time when we are supposed to be cutting those emissions by 30%, in fact, we're going in exactly the opposite direction. So we need to cause those emissions to level off and then decline. This bill moves us down that road to declining emissions. And here are our opportunities. When you passed the Next Generation Energy Act, you did not pick specific mechanisms to achieve those reductions. Instead, you directed the Department of Commerce, working with the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, to come up with a set of policy recommendations to meet those goals. The Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, you'll be hearing from many of our members in testimony today, took on that charge over the last 10 and a half or 11 months. We have concluded our voting and negotiations, and what we have determined is two things. First, looking at only the legislation that already exists, much of which was passed in 2007, the Renewable Electricity Standards and the Next Generation Energy Act efficiency goals, we can get a good grip on reducing the growth in emissions. But we don't have any mechanism now in law that would cause emissions to go down by 15% by 2015. That's what this bill seeks to do. The really good news from the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, and I hope you'll all take a look at the website, because what it says is, if we enact and implement as a state the set of about 45 policy recommendations, we can achieve the 30% by 2025 goal at low cost in Minnesota. The other opportunity for us going forward is that Governor Pawlenty has started or is about to start a process of negotiation with other states and a province to take a look at how we can get a heartland, a Midwestern carbon market going, and try to lead the nation with the best possible set of economic solutions for Minnesota's interests. So we have an opportunity now in that process and through this bill to establish principles through which the governor can negotiate the highest possible type of market for Minnesota's interests. So what will be good for the heartland economy and achieve the greatest possible emissions reductions? You'll be hearing from the next two witnesses about specific costs and opportunities within this bill. We hope that you will continue to take the leadership going forward. Minnesota Environmental Partnership and Fresh Energy strongly support the passage of Senate File 2818, and we look forward to working together with all stakeholders so that we can actually achieve the reductions that are required in the Next Generation Energy Act and build economic opportunities and growth within Minnesota. Thank you.
Questions for these witnesses? What exactly, how does the cap and trade make emissions go down?
Well, I can try, but you're probably more experienced in answering this question than I am. I mean, basically, you're going to set a limit of emissions. You're going to say, okay, how much are we emitting right now? That's our starting point for emissions. And then every year, you're going to go down. It's really that simple.
Mr. Chairman?
Straight.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, what we're trying to do is rectify the problem that actually, when you look at it, when I drive my car, I have no economic incentive, no economic reason to drive a more efficient car for carbon purposes because I'm not paying for the carbon. I'm not acknowledging in the price tag or in my behavior that I'm contributing to the global warming problem. So there's nothing in statute, there's nothing in rules in Minnesota that says we need to limit and reduce those emissions. What I love about the carbon cap and trade idea is it sets the right goal, which is we need to reduce emissions, and then it causes government to step back, which I think is right, and you want to create the strongest possible market with market regulations that will allow the market to determine the lowest cost set of ways to meet that reducing cap over time.
So did we already create the cap last year?
No. All we did was set goals for how much we're going to reduce. That's the 15% by 2015 is the first interim goal. So this is where the heavy lifting begins to start that process. The Renewable Energy Standard and the efficiency bills that were passed help us move in that direction in the electricity sector. But they're not a comprehensive solution to our state's overall greenhouse gas emissions. They're an important part of the solution. But we're looking at the whole state's economy. That's why we include transportation, buildings, other things that are not just captured under the RES and the efficiency laws. And the cap really just sets this umbrella policy that says we're going to meet those goals. And you have to overall, our state has to meet those goals for reduction. But the marketplace gets to decide how to do that by the means of the trading of allowances. So you have your allowance for a certain amount you can emit. You need it, you use it. If you can reduce your emissions, you have this allowance that you can sell to somebody else who needs it. But overall, there's a cap on how much is allowed to be emitted across our state.
Does this bill set that cap?
No, it does not.
All right. It's just saying these are the parameters we'd like when it is set.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Okay. And then regarding the trade, how does trading, first of all, remind me, what do you trade and how does that lower pollution?
You want to try? Don't
maybe.
Sure. We'll try it. Sure. Yeah. Why don't you go ahead and testify?
Is this part of your testimony anyway?
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and give us your testimony?
Sure. Be happy to. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Duke Bascom. I am the founder and CEO of Global Green Energy, which is a private investment firm solely dedicated to clean, efficient energy. Not clean technology, but clean, efficient energy. I found Global Green Energy in 2000 as a California LLC while living in California. And to say the least, the water cooler talk in 2000 was a little quieter than it is today about the various dynamics associated with this proposition. The success for G2E, Global Green Energy, I shortened to G2E, is fairly simple. Profitable environmental benefit through clean, efficient energy. It can't be just profitable, and it can't just be environmental benefit. It's got to be profitable environmental benefit. That is G2E's definition of success, and it should be the expectation of the state of Minnesota and people who participate in a cap and trade system. By way of brief background, I was also a member of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, otherwise known as MCAG. I have no political or personal relationships with anybody who organized the MCAG and essentially had not met anybody in that room before I showed up 9 months ago. I was a member of the Electricity Supply Sub-Twig, which was our subgroups, the cross-cutting twig, and also initially served as the group leader for the cap-and-trade subgroup, and then I believe was helpful in getting it established as a twig or primary subgroup in and of itself. I believe that the MCAG was an excellent beginning, that it established a direction towards meeting the goals that the state of Minnesota has laid out. I would also applaud the fact that those goals have been established because they are leading goals in this country. And in order to meet those goals, you got to be pointed in the right direction. MCAG begins pointing you in the right direction. The single greatest immediate need for anything associated with climate change, global warming, or meeting your goals is external pricing of greenhouse gases. Simply put, pay as you play. External pricing of greenhouse gases. And until there is an external pricing on greenhouse gases, there will be no progress in the necessary direction. There are two mechanisms for external pricing. One is a carbon tax, and the other is a cap and trade program. They're fundamentally different in the sense that a carbon tax will give you certainty of price, but not certainty of reduction. A cap and trade program will give you certainty of reduction because of the cap, but it will not give you certainty of price. It's a fundamental distinction. The math is similar in terms of what companies do, people who pollute more, people who pollute less, but it's a material, critical distinction that I would suggest you understand. There are certain questions that I found important coming out of 8 months on the MCAG, with my highest single priority as participating in that to be the cap and trade program, the external pricing of greenhouse gases. And on the executive summary from the MCAG report, which is still in draft form, I'd like to read three things that answer the following questions. Number one, what is cap and trade? This is on page 8.1 or 8-1. It is a system by which the sources within covered sectors find and achieve the lowest cost emissions reduction investments. Secondly, what is the beauty of a cap and trade system? Same page, 8-1. Since the government regulates only the total emissions, the means by which the reductions are achieved is left to the individual covered sources. Number three, how is value realized for participants in a cap and trade system? 8-1. Through trading, participants with lower costs of compliance can choose to overcomply and sell their additional reductions to participants for whom compliance costs are higher. In this fashion, the overall costs of compliance are lower than would otherwise be the case. It is counterintuitive, but nevertheless well and broadly accepted that everybody's costs are less under a cap and trade system. To summarize, I believe that a cap-and-trade system is not an umbrella necessarily. It is not a framework, nor is it a replacement for any other policy that the MCAG or anybody else might come forward with. It is an integral part of a system that leads you in the direction to accomplishing the changes embedded in your goals. Number two, the most important thing, I believe, is that government does what government should do, which is to establish the standards that are in the best interest of the public. And then the market does what the market should be best at, which is to find the lowest cost solutions to meet those standards. Government's not picking technologies. Government's not telling a particular business how to execute its business. It's saying, here's the standard in the form of the cap. Now you figure out the lowest cost means of getting there. And by the way, in a cap and trade system, everybody's costs, generally speaking and widely accepted, are lower. Finally, for a cap and trade system to maximize its value, and therefore to be maximizing the benefit to the state of Minnesota and citizens of Minnesota, it must be simple, clear, and transparent. To the extent it is less simple, less clear, and less transparent, there will be less value because there will be more risk. Risk equals value. I would applaud the state of Minnesota, the governor and his representatives, and the support from legislators and citizens for the Midwest governor's initiative towards a greenhouse gas system or program. We found in the MCAG that consistently across the board, the numbers came back. They're broad numbers. They're directional numbers. But the state of Minnesota is disadvantaged by going at a cap-and-trade system by itself. Therefore, it is in Minnesota's best interest to go after being part of a larger group, a larger trading system. There are more options. There are more trades. And there's more efficiency in this particular case through a larger, more robust system. This is not to say that ultimately a national system is not in the best interest. But I would suggest to you, I personally believe there'll be a national system in this country in 2010. I don't care whether you elect a Republican or a Democrat. I'll bet you, if you're a betting person, that there is a cap and trade system in this country in 2010. I would suggest to each of you to go to U.S. Climate Action Partners on the web and look at the large corporations who have come together in December of 2006, do global business, and say to the United States government, we got to have a cap and trade, and we got to have it as soon as possible. In the meantime, it is in the Midwest's best interest, and it is in the state of Minnesota's best interest to continue the conversation, to continue taking the action steps leading to, not presuming in lieu of, a national cap and trade system. If you think in either or terms, you will be doing yourself a disservice. We can be on a parallel path. It is not duplicative. It is not inefficient because time is the enemy. Now, one other thing about the Midwestern Governor's Initiative that I think is of imperative importance and we discussed and agreed upon at the MCAG is that for the Midwestern states, who are kind of a nature and industries, you know, broadly speaking, similar to each other, there is a greater voice by six states coming together and speaking from a leadership position to the national cap-and-trade considerations and development than an individual state like Minnesota by itself. So there is tremendous work that is being done right now, regardless of whether you stay at a regional system or whether in the high likelihood you get to a national system. But if you look either or you wait, you're at a disadvantage. What about 2018, at least from my perspective? The sectors have been identified. The more sectors, the better the documentation, the less the administrative costs, the better off everybody is. Everybody ought to be in the boat paying as you play. Secondly, and probably the most important decision you can make is about auctions. And the reason for that, you've got auction and you've got allowance, or allocation rather. In the instance of an allocation, you are giving an asset which has a market value to a company, to an emitter, for free. No charge. And then they can get whatever value out of it they can get out of it that may or may not be tied to reductions. It's a free asset. In the instance of an auction, you are giving money to the government. Now, at that point, people who are skeptical or people who are trying to slow the train down will say, wait a minute, that's a windfall, which is why the Carbon Trust Fund and the consideration, the conversation, and some initial decisions about it are imperative. Because to the extent that you can specifically channel those funds to change the behavior that underlies this greenhouse gas problem, you will be better off. We will all be better off. If you put it into the general fund or something that doesn't have, you know, some kind of lockbox characteristics to it, it's going to take longer and it will ultimately cost more. So I think that it is timely. I think it's beneficial. And I think that it's good common sense to have the conversation about auctions, hopefully to get to auction because there's greater value there than there is an allocation. And as part of that, to look at this issue of a carbon trust fund. There is also the issue of offsets and safety valves. Let's go back up. Is it simple, clear, and transparent? To the extent you have offsets and safety valves, which everybody wants, you're going to make the cap and trade system less simple, less clear, might be transparent about what they are, but you're going to diminish the value and the overall change is going to take longer. And if it takes longer, ultimately it's going to cost more. The studies on governance and economics are an excellent idea. They're actions you can take now. They are beneficial. They got to be done at some point. So why not get after them when you have the time to get after them? I'd like to summarize with, I guess, four things that I've heard over the last 8 months or so. People might suggest to you that just focus on the current programs. You've got some marvelous efficiency, renewable energy standards, nation leading. Some people will suggest to you just focus on those. Don't worry about these other MCAG things that were suggested. Let's focus on what I would refer to as the low-hanging fruit. It's easier. You can get your head around it. Secondly, don't do anything for right now. Let's wait till we get this Midwestern Governor's Initiative underway. Thirdly, let us take care of it. Whoever it is, let us take care of it. You just wait. And finally, don't do anything until the details are all really nailed down. Now, this may sound a little ludicrous to you, but I believe in it in my heart of hearts. The analogy to what this is really about are the following four things. Number one, mobilizing for World War II. Number two, constructing the federal highway system. Number three, the attitude and preparedness that came with the Cold War. And number four, putting a man on the moon in terms of the money and the commitment. If climate change is right, the analogy of change are exactly in those four considerations. And the question to each one of you is, can you afford to be wrong? Can you afford to wait? And therefore, what I would like to leave you with is this. Take action. Secondly, start immediately. And thirdly, think as big and long-term as you possibly can. Anything you can do now, do it. If you accept the fact that you can't afford to bet and be wrong. And if you therefore accept that time is your enemy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much. My name is Steve Pulaski. I am an economist. I work at the University of Minnesota, where I hold an endowed chair in environmental economics. I was also a member of the MCAG, of the Technical Working Group on the Cap and Trade, and the Energy Supply Technical Working Group. I want to address my comments to talking from an economic point of view about the cap and trade system and some specifics of the cap and trade system as it would get implemented. First of all, as you've heard, the cap and trade system is a very straightforward, I'd say simple, but very powerful idea. It's simple because it really is, as it says, cap and trade. It's powerful because it harnesses market forces to meet an environmental goal. So the environmental goal here that we're worried about is reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The cap here would have a specified limit on the amount of emissions. So the total number of allowances that would be handed out would be equal to the cap. Then the trade part is to allow sources the flexibility to meet this cap in the least cost manner. So the cap part is really about the environment. The trade part is about achieving that in the most economically efficient manner. The advantages of a cap and trade in order to meet this environmental goal are that it allows flexibility by the regulated entities. No one's telling them exactly how to do it. It's up to them to figure out how to achieve, you know, what are the lowest cost means of achieving the goal, of meeting the cap. There are a number of examples of cap and trade that have been implemented. This is an idea from economics that dates back to the 1960s. In air pollution, it was mentioned, Senator Anderson mentioned it, the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 dealing with acid rain. There was a national level program to reduce SO2 emissions from electric utilities and large industrial sources. It's recently been expanded to include nitrogen oxides emissions. The program here has worked very well, and one of the things I would stress is the reason why it has worked very well is that they paid careful attention to many of the details of implementation, and I'll come back to that point in a moment. In Minnesota, we have used a cap and trade on a limited basis to improve water quality on the Minnesota River. And in climate change, cap and trade has been used, is being used right now in Europe, the European trading system. Also in the U.S., there is a voluntary program, the Chicago Climate Exchange. I'm proud to say that the University of Minnesota is actually a member of the Chicago Climate Exchange. But now what I want to get to is some of the important design or architecture of a cap and trade. And as I indicated before, it's important to get many of the design principles correct if you really want to realize the promise of cap and trade. So I want to talk about three things in particular, one that's come up previously in the discussion here, and that's the allocation, the initial allocation of allowances, whether to auction them off or to hand them out. The second thing I want to talk about is how do you monitor and enforce the system. And the third thing that I want to talk about is sectoral coverage under the cap and trade, and how does this fit with other programs. So first, on the question of initial allocation of allowances. So these allowances are going to get out to the regulated entities, to the firms. How do you do this? Well, there are two main ways to do this. One is to auction them, to make people purchase them at auction, to sell them to the highest bidder. And the second is to hand them out freely. It's typically done via what's called grandfathering. So you base the allowances on the basis of past emissions. So if you've had a lot of emissions in the past, you tend to get more allowances. If you haven't had emissions or if you're a new entrant into the industry, you don't get you typically do not get allowances. Now, most economists favor the auction route, and that's for a couple of reasons. I think the most fundamental reason why economists favor it is that this is a, you know, the point here is we created this market because we're trying to realize or create economic incentives for this valuable reduction of emissions. So once you've created this market, you have a valuable asset. As Duke alluded to, these are valuable assets. Why would you hand these out for free to the sources that have, in a sense, in the past, done the emissions? There's a powerful principle here, which is called the polluter pays principle. So the issue here is there are costs to emissions. Those people who cause the emissions, in a sense, should pay for the privilege of continuing the emissions. And that's the polluter pays principle. And by auctioning it, you're really embodying the polluter pays principle within the cap and trade system. One other reason for an auction is that it is just simple fairness. Again, if you grandfather these in on the basis of past performance, as Senator Anderson said, if you've done a good job in the past of reducing emissions, you get less of a valuable asset than a neighbor who has not done a good job in the past of reducing emissions. Now, there was controversy on this point, and I'm sure you'll hear more about it today. The Cap and Trade Technical Working Group, which was overall a model of congeniality and consensus, could not agree on this point. And the disagreements split basically along the lines of those of us, myself included, who favored auctions for the reasons I alluded to, and many industry groups that did not. And I understand the points here. We're talking about assets that could be up in the billions of dollars. If I were in industry, I would love to have an asset in the billions of dollars handed to me rather than have to pay for it. The one issue that I think bears careful attention from those who make the point about not auctioning, about allocating, you know, handing them out. At least initially, there is going to be a transition period, and careful attention in the transition period that bears some scrutiny. The second point that I wanted to talk about was monitoring and enforcing of a cap and trade system. And I'd like to talk for a moment about the SO2 program, the acid rain program that US EPA administers. They have a system where they continually monitor the emissions from all regulated sources. There is a registry of emissions. It's very clear who has done what, and at the end of the period, whether sources have the number of allowances to match their emissions. An equivalent thing has to be done in the cap and trade system for greenhouse gases. Now, for the most part, this can be done by tracking use of fossil fuels. There are other sources of greenhouse gas emissions. It is less easy to track the emissions from those, so than agriculture and the forestry sector. What you really want in this system is to be able to maximize the simplicity and transparency and the ease with which regulated sources can meet the system. So that's an important design principle.
Dr. Pulaski, does this bill set up these systems that you're talking about?
I actually think that one of the important things to think about, and I'd actually defer to Senator Anderson, who I think knows the bill much better than I do. But one of the important things, really, to think about here is have we set up appropriate tracking of emissions, and have we set up registries? And I do want to emphasize that that's an important thing. And I'll defer to
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Anderson.
Yeah,
I think the point has been made.
we need to consider some time here as well for the opposition.
Okay. The last point that I want to cover is how broad. What's the sectoral coverage of the cap and trade? In principle, you want, as has been indicated, to have as complete coverage over the economy as possible. The advantages of doing that is that you gain greater certainty on the environmental side. You know exactly what emissions will be. And fairness would also say that, you know, everybody is in this together. The only restriction I would put on that comes back to the point that I just made about monitoring and enforcement. For those areas, as in agriculture and forestry, where it is difficult to monitor emissions or emissions reductions, you want to get at those not under cap and trade, but under some other programs. And so I think that's an important design principle, and that is the design principle that is in this bill. So to conclude, I think it's very important to, as others have said, there's a very important environmental goal here to make. As an economist, I think that what we want to do is to use the mechanisms in place to harness the market forces to meet this environmental goal in the least cost manner. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for any of the witnesses? Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, and I didn't catch your name. I'm sorry, but yes. I imagine it's Dr.
Dr. Pulaski.
Okay.
Is his name, yes.
The two methods that are mentioned in trying to address this issue, one was the carbon tax and one was the cap and trade. Are there any other choices out there? both of them seem to be have a kind of a penalty-type approach. One being tax and the other being cap, restrictions of one sort or another. Isn't there another option that could be looked upon? And I'm thinking like incentives, the approach of, research and technology. And I know it also was mentioned that, if you use the cap and trade, those parties that are interested they're free to do things on their own, but it's still a restrictive approach versus shooting the satellites up to the moon. That was incentives. That was money put in for research. First of all, capturing the best scientists from Germany. And then money put in from our government to try to beat the Russians. I mean, that was not. That was purely an incentive program. And so I'm thinking that isn't there a better way, or another way, such as incentives or.
Dr. Pulaski.
Okay. Yes, please. Thank you. An excellent question. There are a number of ways that people have suggested, and as with many complicated problems, I would suggest that there's no single answer here. So certainly incentives for research and development in low-carbon energy would be one approach. I wouldn't consider that necessarily a substitute or, that I would only do one or the other. I think that the main issue that I want to get back to, though, on the cap and trade is that, in a sense, it, from an economic point of view, the beauty of it actually is that it does create incentives. I mean, here is a way, you're supposed to meet this standard. If you can figure out a whiz-bang way of doing this for less cost, you can do this. You can sell those permits. So there is, I would claim that there is a positive economic incentive associated with this program, but your point is right. There are other approaches here, and I would certainly think that given the scale of the problem, one would want to have investment in new energy sources that were more climate friendly. And as I said, I would not consider that. I personally would do both.
Could I take a crack at that, Mr. Chairman?
Just to follow up on this. And this might be totally crazy because I don't have the science background, but I mean, you talk about tons of carbon, and in the bill it talks about, you know, some other kinds of chemicals versus, carbon dioxide, obviously, most people understand what that is, but some of the other chemicals. I mean, it would be interesting to take, let's say, 1 acre of trees and how much carbon that those trees use, and figure out, like, maybe if we planted 10,000 acres of trees, would it offset the emissions from, you know, one of those plants? I'm sure that's all part of it, but carbon dioxide is friendly to our environment. I mean, we need it.
One person to answer that. Which one of you would like to?
Well, if I could take a crack, Mr. Chairman, two answers. One,
Mr. Bascom,
that issue is addressed of planting trees in the MCAG plan, and yes, there is benefit to it. To your first question, we won't get to 2025, and we clearly won't get to 2050 goals unless we have new technologies. And the real answer to your question about incentives lies in the fact that you have to level the playing field, because a new clean technology has no pollution impact or cost. There's a zero in that category. So if fossil fuels don't have a pay-as-you-play cost, then they're at a disadvantage. And therefore, there's less incentive, less opportunity, less force for new technologies to come along. We could well get to 2015, pretty much 2025, with the stuff we got, but we won't get there eventually without new technologies, and that's why you have to have that cost. And the most efficient way, the lowest cost way, to get at that set of costs is, in fact, through the external pricing via cap and trade system.
I think Senator Stump's question is there pricing consideration for an ethanol plant, for example, that uses cellulosic product through native diversified plantings, and is therefore carbon neutral? Do they get consideration for that?
Yes.
Or does a paper mill, for example, get credit for planting 10,000 trees and therefore reducing carbon in the air?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So those are all factored in.
They are taken in. Anything carbon or carbon equivalent related is taken into consideration.
Okay. So it's not just what's coming out of the smokestack.
No, absolutely not. That's an excellent question because it goes to the heart of the life cycle set of considerations, which haven't been accounted for previously.
Thank you. We got to move on to the next set of witnesses.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move out of the way.
Commissioner Garvey, would you like to join us? I've got 10 more people after Commissioner Garvey, so maybe if some of the like industries would like to consider kind of coming up to the table together afterwards, after Commissioner Garvey's, that would be helpful in expediting it. And we're looking at about 5 minutes or less per witness. Commissioner Garvey, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Edward Garvey. I'm the director of the Office of Energy Security and also the deputy commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I've been serving in both these roles, the directorship, for now a couple of weeks since the governor created the Office of Energy Security, and in the deputy commissioner role, leading his energy policies for the last 5 years. In that role, I'm also the point person on many of the climate change issues. Mr. Chairman, you have several things that I've given you. I'll sort of spare you a PowerPoint outline. It's a quick summary of the MCAG process. You've heard a little bit about it. I don't think time permits us to go through that today, but if you have questions about that. You also have, I believe, a copy of the actual accord that Governor Pawlenty and the six other governors signed in November of last year, and I'll be going through that momentarily. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have common goals. Let me be crystal clear on this. We have common goals, and those common goals are to reduce the state's greenhouse gas emissions. We want those reductions to be done in a way that maximizes the state's economic benefits and opportunities while minimizing the adverse and unintended consequences that may result from those reductions. We believe that we can do those reductions and achieve our goals in three ways. By implementing the existing actions that we've already put in place, most importantly, those put in place by the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007. By taking a set of additional thoughtful steps that are incremental and deliberately done in a way that does not adversely affect our state's economy. And to the topic that's before us, pursuing a regional and hopefully a national cap and trade regime. Common goals, reducing our greenhouse gas emissions in a way that helps our economy, with a regional cap and trade being one of those tools. It's those goals that has led us to this point today. It led the governor to initiate and announce the greenhouse gas initiative reduction program in the December of 2006 to create the Minnesota Greenhouse Gas Climate Change Advisory Group and invite the Center for Climate Strategies to facilitate that group. It has led him and working with other states to actually bring to the fore the summit and the accord that we're talking about today. Common goals that have led to concrete results. Achieving the accord that you have before us was not easy. We had to work with a lot of other states. 12 other states are in the Midwest Governors Association. Not all states signed on to the Greenhouse Gas Accord. Both Governor Pawlenty and Governor Doyle from Wisconsin's leadership, we were able to reach a high-level consensus among states that wanted to go forward and pursue a regional effort. And that's one of the components that I bring before you, is that when we say that we are going to do something and move forward, we do move forward, and we do move forward to strive for achievement of a high-level, bipartisan consensus. Our record in many respects speaks for itself, but let me just mention several of them. The Metropolitan Emission Reduction Program, the implementation of that. The seabed legislation of 2005. Mercury legislation of 2006. Of course, the legislation in 2007, the Renewable Energy Standard, which Senator Anderson, of course, has been one of the chief authors of. But the next generation law itself and the other components, which Senator Dibble is working on as part of the demand efficiency component of that. Nation-leading legislation. In many respects, that legislation passed with fewer no votes than it took the legislature to pass and create the Honeycrisp apple as our state apple. The point is that very important pieces of legislation were passed in ways that we from the administration part, working with stakeholders, working with the legislature, went on and achieved. And I want to sort of bring that to your attention and just sort of walk you through a couple of the provisions of the greenhouse gas accord that we're talking about. And I hope you have a copy of it, but quickly. The governors have agreed to jointly endeavor to establish greenhouse gas reduction targets and timeframes consistent with those of the MGA members and member states and provinces, which means we're going to reconcile the member states' targets. We're going to develop a market-based and multi-sector cap-and-trade mechanism to help achieve greenhouse gas reduction targets. Our commitment to each other and to you already is that we are going to move to a cap-and-trade, and it will be multi-sectoral. We will join the climate registry and enable tracking, management, and crediting for entities that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. You heard Dr. Pulaski talk about how important a registry and inventory is. We're trying to make sure that we count each count each other's emissions in a fair and open and transparent way. And we will develop and implement other associated mechanisms and policies as needed to achieve greenhouse gas reduction targets, such as low carbon fuel standards and regional incentives and funding mechanisms. But that point says that we are going to continue to work together. Other elements of the platform that the governor signed move that forward. It's important for this committee to also appreciate that in the final resolve, we set out a timetable in which this action will occur. I'm reading from the last resolve, Mr. Chairman, that we shall direct our staff, in this case that's mine and my staff and others, and appropriate state agency representatives to develop a work plan and establish a work group to move forward with the program within 2 months of the effective date of this accord. We are in a process of doing that. Many of that work plan is already established. Second, to establish targets for the greenhouse gas emissions reductions and timeframes consistent with the state targets and adopt policies, implementation mechanisms, and any work products deemed necessary within 8 months of the effective date of this accord. Of course, that's 8 months from November, so that's June-July timetable. That's underway. We will hit that target. Number three, Mr. Chairman, we will complete and develop development of proposed cap-and-trade agreement and a model rule within 12 months of the effective date of this accord. Again, 12 months of November of 2007, which would be November 2008. So my hope is to come back to you with a model rule that the other states have all agreed to. And finally, being able to come back to you in 12 months, we expect other states to have 18 months to implement it, which is what the final component of that resolve says. Complete the undertaking set forth herein within 30 months of the effective date of this accord. So, Mr. Chairman, we have a commitment of the governors to work together to develop a multi-sectoral cap-and-trade greenhouse reduction plan in a way that we can get this done. My concern that with the bill before us is that as we go into these negotiations, it constrains us from having the flexibility to negotiate with our neighboring and sister and colleague states in order to achieve the high-level consensus agreement that we've proven to be able to do in the past moving forward. Mr. Chairman, that is our biggest concern on this. There are substantive concerns, too, but most importantly, this is a procedural issue that if these are enacted into law, our ability to actually negotiate the high-level compromise that I think we want to achieve, that we will bring back to you by the end of this year in time for next legislative session, we won't be able to do that because of the constraints in this bill. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony for now. I hope I did it in a brief enough time, and I can sit for questions that the members may have.
You did. Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner Garvey. I'm glad you mentioned our recent successful efforts. They're good efforts, the Mercury Bill, the Renewable Energy Standard, the Efficiency Act, the Global Warming Bill from last year, et cetera. But the full story is that, you know, those weren't easy, and you know, we weren't all skipping through the tulips. Those were tough efforts, and the administration and the legislature and the various stakeholders did not see eye to eye. And so there was a lot of talking, a lot of compromise. Frankly, there were some power plays that were done, you know, in various committees and on the floor and that sort of thing by various parties until we figured out how to accommodate each other and find out what our mutual interests and goals were and set forth and got rolled up our sleeves and got something done. But that doesn't quite square with what I'm hearing you ask for here today. What happened was the administration and the legislature, in conjunction with a lot of the folks in this room, you know, had a debate, had a wrangle, had a tussle, and arrived at some agreed upon outcomes. And then we were skipping through the tulips and slapping each other in the back and going to Chicago and getting awards and all kinds of great things. That was wonderful. So I don't understand the resistance to having that same conversation with the legislature as as Governor Pawlenty moves forward to try to establish a cap-and-trade system, which I think everyone can agree is going to be vital, or, you know, maybe Senator Stumpf doesn't quite yet agree, and we have to definitely bring the public along because the questions are fundamental and confusing and the like. So why not, what I hear you asking for is, just leave us alone. We've got this work plan, and then we're going to come up with a framework. We'll have the rule in 12 months. I mean, it sounds like the administration is asking for full negotiating authority without consultation. They'll bring something back that we have to either accept or reject. It's going to be tough. The devil is certainly going to be in the details, and I would ask that there be some more collaboration around some of those details, because those are going to make a crucial difference in what the outcomes are. So I'm just concerned about why now that we've found our way and learned our lesson through all these difficult efforts, how to work together and create something that's, rather than come back in 12 months and have a big fight over something that you've worked so hard to bring back to us.
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Dibble, you've raised a very, very good point and about the obligations of parties that have to sort of deal with one another and try to achieve a high common denominator, certainly there rather than a low common denominator, is to proverbially not take the "it's my way or the highway," because if you do, you end up becoming roadkill when you do that. The concern, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Dibble, is that if a requirement on what we have to come back is put into law, how do I negotiate? How do I deal with if another state says, we're sorry, Minnesota, your law says that we're not going to accept your law in these discussions? We'll come close, three quarters of the way there, but your law says you can't. What is my position? My position is our law says, I'm sorry, I can't move off that position to reach a high-level compromise with you, Wisconsin, you, Iowa, you, Illinois, you, Ohio, which is an observer, et cetera. That's actually the concern, is that it constrains us from achieving that kind of high compromise.
Doesn't it strengthen your position? All you have to say is, I'm sorry, Minnesota law requires us to have an auction, for example. You negotiate from there.
Mr. Chairman, that certainly would solidify my position. But if another state says, we're sorry, but we don't want 100% front-end auction for every sector that's being covered, my response has to be, I'm sorry, I'm really strong in my position because my law constrains me.
I'm not reading where it says 100%.
Mr. Chairman.
It says all.
All allowances.
Page
okay.
two,
so
line
that,
32.
That's, all right. Okay. All right. Senator Dibble.
Well, the converse, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Garvey, is also true. I guess the question is how high a level? It is entirely plausible that the governor is going to bring back something that is unacceptable to the legislature, and in its eminent wisdom as a representative of the people and as a steward of important public benefit and public policy. And so why wouldn't the governor want to know some initial priorities and values of the legislature? Because this is going to have to come back to the legislature, and the legislature is going to have to deal with this. And what I hear you asking for is the kind of authority that for example, a Bush administration would bring to international trade agreements, and much of what has been brought back has been unacceptable in terms of labor and environmental policy. And I don't think we want, an all or nothing, come back and accept it whole or reject it. So I would think that the governor and the administration would want to know some of the values and priorities and important aspects that the legislature is interested in.
Mr. Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Dibble. The mutual working relationship of the administration and the legislature on these kind of matters is very important. As I've already established, we work very hard to try to find the high-level common denominator. Senator Anderson, the bill's author at the outset, indicated that she wanted to work with parties to find a way to do that. My message to her and to you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is that I, too, want to achieve the same thing with the proposal that's before this committee. Certainly, hearing and understanding what you as members of the legislature have to say is important to us and should be factored in when we do negotiate. And so I look forward to those kinds of conversations, both in the context of this agreement, but in certainly moving forward with all of these kinds of issues. And so, Senator Anderson, I look forward to working with you to try to find a way, like we've done in the past, to achieve a high-level common denominator where we can address my concerns of locking us into a position, at the same time making sure we understand the legislature and your points of view as we go forward.
Main part of a cap-and-trade program is the level of the cap and the mechanism of the trading. Would you agree?
Again, sir?
The main part of a cap-and-trade program is the level of the cap and the mechanism of the trading. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think in sort of, actually, sorry, Dr. Pulaski is probably the true expert on this, but I'll sort of, that certainly the cap is important. It's the front-end allocation of the credits underneath the cap. Are they auctioned off or given away our allowances or some kind of other mechanism? Then there is the mechanism for the trading between entities that receive the credits and how that is allocated. How do you count it? Who counts it? Who do you true it up with? How do you make sure that folks are staying underneath the cap, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, those are countless details. But with that one caveat of cap initial allocations mechanism, and then the mechanisms, I would agree.
Does this bill set the level of the cap of emissions?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the way I'm interpreting it is that we're using 2005 emission levels, but the cap has not been crystal clear. In my opinion, it's not crystal clear.
Except for the mention of the auction, does it set the mechanism for the trading?
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't believe it does.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out, we haven't really spent a lot of time on the language, but I want members would look at page 3, line 14 of the bill. It says, the governor is strongly encouraged to work with the other signatories to the Midwest Greenhouse Gas Accord to develop a regional cap and trade program that incorporates the principles in this bill. So I just want to be clear that I mean, constitutionally, we don't have the power to tell the governor what he can and cannot do when he's negotiating with another state, whether we pass a law or not, whether we send him a letter or whether we pass a law. I think it's pretty clear that we can't force the governor to negotiate something that meets this law. At least I don't think we have that authority, and that's not what this bill is intending to do, to force the governor to do anything. It's intended to say that the legislature has certain principles that we think are critically important when we move forward in a cap and trade to protect our public interests. And we just want to express that intent so the governor is aware of it. Obviously, this bill has to go through 6 or more committees in the Senate, same in the House, a great deal of give and take just within the legislature to figure out what our intent is. You know, this is the starting point, and this is what my intent is, but I got to get a majority of legislators to agree with me before we even express our intent. And I just think that it makes sense to start that dialogue now rather than saying you have a carte blanche to go do whatever you want and come back in a year or so and tell us what you've come up with, and then we start that dialogue. It's just harder. Once the governor has negotiated something with all these states and then has to bring it back to us and say, here it is, take it and pass it. We need to be involved from day one, and that's what we're trying to do here. And you know, we want to work together. But how we work, how we do things in the legislature is we pass bills. And so that's all that we're doing here.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Anderson, you're kind of what I'm getting here is that you're kind of looking for the advice of advise and consent early. We want to have the input before we get the agreement.
Exactly.
An advisory, so to speak.
We got to move on to the next witnesses. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we've gone a little bit longer than I expected for the proponents, so I will be a little more flexible with the rest of the testimony. But please understand that I risked being struck down in my seat by cutting off a Lutheran pastor.
As far as you know.
More importantly, a friend. So if I'm willing to do that, I'm willing to do that for others. Welcome to the committee.
Wow.
Maybe this guy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Robertson. I am environmental policy consultant to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I would like to beg your indulgence. It will take me a few more than 5 minutes to say what I have to say. But I think it's important. I'm speaking broadly on behalf of the business community. I'm going to make some points that I know that from our experience yesterday that other speakers that follow would also make, and maybe some won't have to make those points if I make them here. So please bear with me. Before I address the specific provisions of the bill, I'd like to provide the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce perspective on where Minnesota stands today on the road to achieve the goals that you set last year in the Next Generation Energy Act. I had the honor of representing the Chamber on the Climate Change Advisory Group, which, as you know, you've heard today, is in the process of finalizing its report. And this is a printed copy of the draft report that's available to you on the website, mnclimatechange.us. I spent a good part of the weekend going through the report, and I really enjoyed being with the folks on this group. We spent a lot of hours, more than 100 people, spent hundreds more hours working on a process that took half the time that it has taken in other states to complete similar processes. As I will describe in more detail in a moment, the MCAG report is not the be-all and end-all prescription for ensuring that 80% of our emissions are reduced by 2050. But it is a good start. And here is what we accomplished in MCAG. First, we reviewed more than 300 options to reduce emissions, and more specifically, we analyzed about 50 options. And the bottom line is that the MCAG recommendations will achieve the 2015 goal, just barely make or fall a little bit short of the 2025 goal, and will put the state on a trajectory to achieve a 50% reduction by the year 2050. Secondly, the MCAG report concludes that the legislature has already adopted the options that have the highest reduction potential to reduce greenhouse gases. And I would refer you to the first page of my handout, the graph. The reductions that you set in motion last year, the renewable energy standard, and the 1.5% energy efficiency goal are by far the highest reduction options that were examined by MCAG. Now, I said that MCAG, in their report, is not the be-all and end-all. Because of time and lack of precision in projecting forward 40 years to 2050, we concentrated on the 2025 goal. Another shortcoming was the inability to flesh out all of the options or fully analyze the cost impact on consumers. I refer you to my handout on the second page. There's a memo dated January 23rd that I wrote to my fellow members of the MCAG group. Many of the proposals lack specificity on implementation mechanisms. More analysis of the costs to consumers and to businesses is needed. The analysis only provides a broad assessment of societal costs. We did not answer the question, cost to whom, and the competitive impact on specific business sectors and the cost to end-use consumers was not addressed. In addition, there is no accounting of governmental costs. Many of the proposals require governmental funding to implement them, but the cost to the taxpayers is not assessed in the report. But the overarching option, intended as the framework for achieving the aggressive statutory goals that you'd already have already put in place, is a cap-and-trade system. And I refer you to page 2 of that January 23rd memo for the Chamber's position on cap-and-trade. We believe that a cap-and-trade system is best implemented at the federal level. There was unanimous agreement on that with the members of MCAG. However, until legislation is passed in Washington, we will participate, as recommended by MCAG, in the development of a regional cap-and-trade system as part of the Midwest Governor's Greenhouse Gas Accord. In our view, no further legislation is necessary to move to the next stage in developing a regional cap-and-trade system. The law you passed last year in Section 216H.02, Subdivision 6, says, and I quote, "The state must, to the extent possible, with other states in the Midwest region, develop and implement a regional approach to reducing greenhouse gas emissions from activities in the region, including consulting on a regional cap-and-trade system," end quote. Just 6 months ago, after you enacted that sentence, the Midwest governors signed an agreement to do just that. And now the difficult task begins, as has already been discussed, to develop the details of a regional system. Which brings me to the bill, Senate File 2018. We oppose the bill because it prematurely establishes a state policy that emission allowances should be distributed through an auction. There was no consensus, as you've heard, on the issue of an auction in the MCAG. The draft report in Chapter 8, page 7, notes that several methods are available. Partial auction, several methods available for distribution, and it recommends that there be further study of 5 different alternatives: a partial auction with a partial free distribution, a shift to an auction over time, an auction for unregulated entities, a sector-specific distribution system, and a performance-based market system. Now, the MCAG consultant modeling of cap-and-trade options included an estimate of auctioning allowances in a Midwest regional cap-and-trade. They actually looked at, projected out what those costs might be if there was an auction of the allowances. And I would refer you to the last page of my handout, which is page 48 of Appendix K of the draft MCAG report. Table 17A shows that auctioning allowances at a projected price of $46 per ton would raise $5.09 billion for the state in 2025. This is after emissions have been reduced by 30% to meet that goal in the year 2025. So there's 30% less emissions that are paying that $46 price. So assuming that allowances are auctioned at the beginning of a cap-and-trade program, when most of that 30% emissions have not been reduced, the revenue to the state would be much higher than $5 billion. For example, if, say, we're looking at the year 2015 and only half of the 30% reductions have occurred, then and you applied, say, a $35 price per ton, that auction would raise over $9 billion for the state. So without a doubt, the auctioning of allowances is a multi-billion dollar revenue enhancer for the state treasury. In effect, an auction is equivalent to a carbon tax. An auction is not necessary to make a cap-and-trade system work. The cap on emissions will be enforced through law. emitters have to pay the cost to reduce emissions below the cap or buy allowances on the market if that is cheaper. An auction would eliminate trading. Paying the auction price for all emissions adds an additional cost well beyond the cost to achieve the emissions reduction under the cap. Now, the proponents of an auction say that it's needed, as the bill says, and I quote from the bill, to reduce disruptive economic impacts of the transition on workers, businesses, and consumers, end quote. We appreciate the recognition that there will be disruptive economic impacts on workers, businesses, and consumers. We support the economic study that is required in Section 6, Subdivision 4 of the bill, which requires estimates of increases in energy prices and the impact of such price increases on businesses and family income, and an analysis of ways to avoid putting Minnesota industries subject to the cap and trade at a competitive disadvantage. This is exactly the economic analysis that I said earlier is needed, but is not included in the MCAG report. We need such an analysis, but the bill turns the policy decision on its head. The economic study must come first, and as recommended by MCAG, options relating to an auction system of the allowances must be evaluated with our new stakeholder partners in the Midwest states. Senate File 2818 makes a huge revenue policy decision without any economic analysis, without any discussion with Midwest partners who will be integral to implementing that revenue decision, to impose a multi-billion dollar cost on consumers to reduce the impact of another policy decision, cap and trade, which has not been fully evaluated for its economic impact. This is an unfortunate circle that we think must be broken. Mr. Chairman, I want to reiterate that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is committed to move forward to develop the details of a regional, Midwest regional cap and trade system. And our constant caution, as you can well expect, is that we must always take into account the impact on consumers and the Minnesota economy. Our opposition to Senate File 2818 should in no way be viewed as an attempt to delay or to block a cap and trade system. The process that you set in motion last year in the Next Generation Energy Act is working. We learned in the MCAG process that the task is daunting. There is no magic wand of legislation that will make the 80% of our greenhouse gas emissions go away. To achieve the goal will require significant change in our economic and our social behaviors, as well as huge technological innovation. The Next Generation Energy Act and the MCAG process have put Minnesota on a climate change pathway, and we think we should keep moving. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. John Rolfe from Medtronic.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Rolfe. I'm here representing Medtronic Incorporated here in the cities. A little background, I came to Medtronic about a year ago as their corporate energy manager, and I'm here to represent kind of the ground troops in this war. We're the ones, I'm probably the only guy in the room here who's the one left that has to actually make the reductions. And I'm here to kind of explain that it's difficult, it can be done. There's technology, there's behavioral change, There's a lot of things that need to be done to make efficiencies happen. And to think that, you know, oh, we can do 30% easy and then we'll do 40% and sell the extras, you know, man, we'll be damn lucky to get the 30%. So what's going to happen at the end? You know, like the natural gas market, when it's cold and everybody wants gas, what's the price do? So what happens when you get to the end and nobody's met their target and now everybody has to go buy? The price goes to infinity? So there's some things to consider when you're dealing with behavioral changes. It's very difficult to do. I've been doing it for over 15 years. Little background, I came from Ford Motor Company for 20 years. Was in their national energy office. I've been doing air conditioning retrofits, lighting retrofits. I've been crawling on balconies to take flue stack temperatures. I mean, I've been down in the pits doing efficiency for a long time. I love this stuff. It's what I do. But I also want to make it clear, I'm not in opposition to the bill. What I'd like to do is work to tweak it a little bit so that for people like me, it's more usable. Because right now, there's not a lot of incentives in here for me. It doesn't give me any tools. It's just a big stick. And what I need is tools to help get things done. I don't need impediments. You also asked to tune this towards the environmental side. So I've made some adjustments on my comments on the run, so I might be a little scattered here. Apologize for that. The whole goal here is reduction of greenhouse gases. That's it. You know, there's economics are involved. Now, there's only two ways to do that, alternate supply and use less. And that's it. That's all there is to it. So the alternate supply is a whole other issue on windmills, on nuclear, on all these other things that we want to try to achieve. The efficiency side is the hard part. And I always equate it to like weight loss. As soon as you stop looking at it, oh, oops, what happened? I thought I was pretty good here for a while. And so the efficiency items are extremely difficult to do. They can be done, but it takes a lot of resources. A couple of the items that I guess I'm concerned about on the environmental side, again, the economics is a different committee, mentioned that the agricultural is not involved. Well, I buy natural gas, too, for our facilities, and I can tell you that the ethanol industry is grabbing a lot of natural gas. It's a very energy-intensive industry. Now, go back to the goal. The goal is reduce emissions. Well, if that type of sector is not held accountable for it, then it's not going to work. So I think the sectors that we include are very, very important. I don't even know if I'm included yet. It says large industrials. I don't know what that means. So I guess that's one issue I think that we need to look at. Another one is behavioral changes. In fact, it was mentioned right at the beginning, one of the worst things we have is old homes. Well, old inner city homes are very, you know, inefficient. So what do we do? Well, it says in the legislation that a lot of this money goes right back to low-income people to pay for the increase in their energy cost so it doesn't affect them. Well, that doesn't drive any behavioral change. They'll still live in the same house and, hey, good, they offset my price increase, so no change there. Well, if that's the area that is inefficient, that's the area we ought to be looking at. So the way it's structured, it's not going to reduce emissions. So we need to tweak the incentives a little bit. Another area that's not included, the commercial building sector is one of the largest growth areas in energy in the country. And if they're not included, there's 30% of the pie that isn't getting looked at. So I think it's critical that we have to look at the whole. You can't just pick on the big ones because they're easier to regulate. I'm a little confused on how regulating the natural gas utilities will make any difference because they can't do anything about it. They don't produce the gas. They can't get more efficient or less carbon in their redelivery to me. So regulating them, to me, is a little confusing on making them reduce. There's a couple things there that, to me, you really have to look at behavioral change and the incentives and which sectors you look at. As far as the cap and trade goes, when I was with Ford, I was the lead negotiator on the carbon Chicago Climate Exchange in 1999. as one of the founding members there, and we were inventing it as we went. So I've been doing the carbon trading cap and trade for a long time. I did Ford's Global Carbon Report, and it's not easy. And there's a lot of complications on, well, we bought Jaguar, we sold Jaguar. We did this, we did that. We outsourced parts to China, so now we're not emitting, but somebody else is. So how do you count this, and how do you count that? And suddenly it gets very complicated very quickly. And to think we can do a little isolated state-only type system isn't going to work. You have to think globally. But you have to act locally, all right? Like this room, this is probably the most inefficient lighting room I've been in a couple of years. So there's, you know, we got to practice what we preach here. It's all behavioral change. I'm not against the cap and trade. I don't like the auction because of things I've mentioned before. But I do think we need to get started. I think we need to start a cap and trade, but we need to be able to have information to negotiate at the national level, which is the only thing that makes any sense at all. We need to start now with at least the tracking and the footprint. Where are we? You can't start unless you know where you're at. So if nothing else, I think we need to adjust it to say that in the future, the allocation of credits will be determined in another system. But for now, we need to establish a tracking and reporting mechanism so that everybody knows where they're at. And there'll be some surprises. People say, wow, I never realized this industry or this sector was so large or so small. So I think at least we got to get started on that part of the business. And with that, I'll end my comments.
Thank you. Next witness is Deborah Bergen, Missouri River Energy Services.
Thank you, Chairman Chaudhry. At this time, in accordance to your earlier request, I would invite any other utility lobbyists who want to join me at the table. Perhaps we can try to speed this along per your request.
That would be great if anyone would like to. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, committee members, for allowing me to be here today. My name is Deborah Bergen. I'm with Missouri River Energy Services. I'm also representing our financing affiliate, Western Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. First of all, we would like to state that we agree with the bill proposal that a state-only cap-and-trade program is not the preferable method. We would prefer a national program, but absent a national program moving forward, we feel that a regional market would be something we could support. Because a cap-and-trade program at its very essence, as you've heard today, is a market. And markets work best with a large variety of participants covering a variety of sectors. If each state were to have its own separate approach or own separate cap and trade, it would cause unintended shifts, cost shifts, and burdens. Therefore, we believe that a larger approach, a broader spectrum, is the better approach. However, we do have some concerns about the bill, some of which will be reiterated by testimony you've already heard and testimony to come. The primary concern is the implementation of a 100% auction approach to the cap-and-trade system. Currently, federal legislation under consideration, namely the Lieberman-Warner bill, allocates 73.5% of allowances in 2012 while submitting the rest, 26.5%, to auction. And then that is further subdivided. For example, a certain amount of those no-cost allowances go to the electric sector, a certain amount to geological sequestration, 5% to credit early action, as well as to the states, 9% to the states themselves to allocate as they see fit. We feel that this is a better approach. Further, the acid rain legislation cap-and-trade program was brought up. When that began, I believe in 1995, with its first allowances, it also did not employ a 100% auction approach. It also allocated allowances based on a formula for fuel distribution, BTU, and other aspects that they took into consideration. So it has been successful, and it too did not start off at the jumping point with a 100% auction. But having said that we don't prefer a 100% a 100% auction, MRAS does also have to say that we recognize that 100% no-cost allocation allowances is probably not a workable option either. As we have seen in Europe, free allocation of allowances without a proper system of checks and balances has allowed abuses of the system. This cannot be tolerated. In addition, the European model has demonstrated that any legislation must also include provisions to minimize the potential for market manipulation. Rather, we recommend studying a hybrid approach. A hybrid approach allowing for limited, no-cost allowances for covered sources would allow for the consumer to benefit by lessening the price impact, particularly in the early stages of moving to a carbon-reduced economic system. At the same time, a hybrid approach would limit the amount of no-cost allowances distributed, thwarting those who would otherwise use allowances to game the system. And therefore, we are recommending that the legislature undertake the study recommended in Section 6, Subdivision 4 of the bill, and use it to carefully examine the costs, the administrative pitfalls, and the market impacts of various allowance hybrid allocation methods before committing to one particular mode ahead of time. I would also note, as Mr. Robertson testified, I was also a member of the Cap and Trade TWIG group. And while we spent months studying the various modeling and basic costs and methods and approaches to a state-only or regional cap-and-trade system, we did not study in depth an allocation method or what that would mean, particularly hybrid approaches. So therefore, again, I would recommend further study is necessary. Another concern with any cap-and-trade legislation, as you've already heard testimony on, is consumer costs. And therefore, we would again encourage this committee, the legislature, and the Midwest Governors Association to look at cost relief measures. The Lieberman-Warner bill, for example, contains methods to allow for banking, trading, and offsetting of allowances. These types of parameters allow for market flexibility and also decrease price volatility. And therefore, MRAS also asked this legislature to continue to consider looking at safeguards, safety valves, and other cost relief measures. We also asked that this legislature and this committee look at the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. This is the first regional cap-and-trade program developed in the United States regarding greenhouse gas emissions. It also employs a safeguard. Upon hitting the RGGI price trigger, the compliance period is extended and the geographical areas from which offsets can be acquired is expanded. And again, the Lieberman-Warner bill is also considering cost relief measures. The reasons for the RGGI safeguard and for any safeguard is clear. As a region or even a nation takes on greenhouse gas reduction policy, vast changes will be needed in many sectors of the economy. Industry, manufacturing, energy fuels, transportation, even residential living. A safeguard will serve as a safety net, allowing the economy to adjust to a new regulatory reality. Lastly, we recommend that the development of new technology is paramount. The bill before you does allocate some proceeds from an auction towards various cost relief measures. However, we feel that a portion of those proceeds should also be invested in technology. Lower-income consumers will not only be subject to higher electric prices under a new reality, but also higher costs for gasoline, home heating, manufactured goods, retail services, and food. The advantage of new technological advancements, regardless of whether they're in the energy, industrial, or agricultural sector, is that will lower emissions directly and permanently. Thus, technology will also reduce the amount of allowances needed and will in turn reduce costs overall in the covered sector and under the cap-and-trade market. With this investment, all sectors will experience long-term cost benefits, which will be passed on to the consumer. Therefore, we again urge this committee and the legislature, as well as the Midwest Governors Association, to consider allocating a portion of proceeds from any auction towards investment into research and development. I thank this committee for their time.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bob Schulte. I'm Interim Chief Executive Officer of Central Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, CMMPA, pronounced CHMPA, not to be confused with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. That's SMPA, our larger sister agency in Rochester. We're a nonprofit wholesale electric power and service agency serving 12 municipal utility members in central and southern Minnesota. These are relatively rural communities. Delano, Glencoe, Sleepy Eye, Windham, Fairfax, Kenyon, Casson, Mountain Lake, Springfield, those kinds. Not big cities here. For public power utilities like our members, they are one and the same as the consumers they serve. We and our members favor a federal approach to carbon regulation as for the reasons people talked about today. And failing a federal approach, and all of us are more or less impatient with the federal progress on that, we believe a regional approach, as has been described by others, is much more preferable than a state-only approach, as been discussed earlier. The governor and the MCAG both approaching it from a regional perspective. In our view, this bill, while its preamble states it supports a regional cap and trade, really seems to default to a state-only program. This bill, in our view, needs to decide what it wants. This relates to some of the discussion we'd had earlier. We are concerned that the bill essentially ties the shoelaces together of the effort to do a regional cap and trade. With all respect, it reads like lobbying a bill through the transom at the governor's office, and the governor's office lobbying the results of negotiations through the transom back. And we suggest, like the discussion that happened earlier today, we've got to find some way to open the door and do that in a more efficient and productive way. We are concerned that this is setting the regional effort up, in terms of the bill as it is now, setting the regional up for failure using the definitions of the bill, and a bill that at its face purports to support a regional effort. With regard to costs, briefly, there's been no testimony or evaluation regarding the provisions of this bill that would allocate carbon allowances or auction them off or even decide whether they, in fact, should be auctioned off. And as these are big dollar numbers for Minnesota consumers, I won't repeat our analysis of it. I would hearken back to Mr. Robertson's of the Chamber of Commerce, $5 billion to $9 billion types of costs for Minnesota consumers in total. The electric industry that we represent in our portion of the state, electric emissions are about a third of the total, all industries total. The Chamber's total was represent total. $5 billion number for all industries, that would represent, if you boil it down to our share of electric sales, that's a wholesale price change of 30%. 30%, and that's the low number that Mr. Robertson was reporting. And so this, and that's only on their electric bills. It doesn't include increases in natural gas bills, on their transportation bills, on products and services they buy. We don't have the answer to that. We just relate that the scale of these numbers is very large, very large. With regards to the bill's provisions to auction off all carbon allowances, we have heard proponents call this a cap and trade and auction. We encourage the legislature to pierce through the technical jargon and see the auction term for what it is. This is a tax. This is a cap and tax bill. At the federal level, such auctions in this very context of carbon regulation are called a stealth tax, like a stealth bomber or a stealth fighter. Stealth because the tax appears in your utility bill, not in a bill that directly comes from the government. The effect on CMMPA's members, whose owners are the consumers themselves, see the term auction as the tax that it really is. The bill specifies that all allowances be auctioned off. In contrast, leading federal bills initially allocate a portion of the allowances at no cost and then phase them out over time. And this is not, in our view, what's been characterized earlier as a free handout to polluters. It's not a breakdown of pure economics that economists would like to see have happen. It is related to transitioning ratepayers, taxpayers, into absorbing the costs that we will face in dealing with the carbon issue. In the utility business, we have a term called a rate shock. That is, if you have a big dollar increase coming to your utility customers, you try to phase that in over time so they can absorb it into their budgets and not try to absorb it all at once. Some of these numbers and not having any allocation of allowances and putting them all up for auction would bring a rate shock, a tax shock, upon our consumers. With regard to the question earlier of Senator Stump with regard to offsets, if we did something good, saved more, did more renewables, did some other things, shouldn't we be entitled to offsets? And the earlier witness, I believe, answered correctly in terms of a cap and trade. Yes, a cap and trade would allow for those types of offsets if you do good things. Our reading of the bill is that this would prohibit such offsets. And if it isn't the intent of the bill, we'd like to have that clarified, that those types of things that the senator's question brought up can actually occur. In summary, if you want a reasonable approach, the bill should facilitate such an approach. And the potential costs of the bill to Minnesota consumers are very large. This needs to be thoughtfully considered in the economics and emissions study provided for in Section 6 of the bill, which we support that section. In fact, we respectfully suggest that study should be done before other portions of the bill so we know what we're getting into. So thank you for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this isn't for the testifier. It's for Senator Anderson. Senator Anderson, you said that before any committees, let's say the Energy Committee next Tuesday, I think, is meeting, that you'd sit down with stakeholders and work out some of the differences?
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, yes. I've been saying that a lot because I want to be really clear about it. In fact, we have a meeting already scheduled for Friday morning in this room, 8 a.m. A lot of people, nobody knows this probably in this room yet, so I hope some of you can come. Because we want to we're scheduled to be in Senator Pretner Solon's committee next Tuesday for a hearing, and she feels very strongly as well that she wants to have some work done in trying to find some common ground before this comes to her committee, and I agree with her.
All right, thank you.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, representing the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association and SEMPA, the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency that Bob's the little brother of. MMUA represents the 126 municipal utilities that provide electric service to mostly small communities in Minnesota. And Greg Oxley, the Director of Government Affairs, would normally be here, but he's in Washington, D.C. today with MMUA. Rather than provide redundant testimony, you've heard all of the points that I was going to make. I just want to emphasize two things. Number one, MMUA and SEMPA support a national solution, which has been suggested by others. And two, that we think at this juncture, any cap-and-trade program implementation would be premature without the analysis of what the impact might be on customers. We've provided you with our statement on the issues and some of the principles that we think are important. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be happy to.
Appreciate you submitting your written remarks in lieu of your abbreviated testimony. Next is Doug Peterson, CenterPoint Energy.
Yes, Mr.
Welcome
Chairman.
To the committee.
Thank you, members of the committee. I am Doug Peterson for CenterPoint Energy. CenterPoint Energy is the largest natural gas utility in Minnesota. Like a number of other people that have testified today, I am a member of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, and I also was on the MCAG Technical Work Group on cap and trade. I'm here today on behalf of our 800,000 customers, of which 95% are either residential or small commercial customers who primarily use natural gas to heat their homes and businesses. I've got three main points that I'm trying to make this afternoon. My first point is that the proposed principles in this bill on cap and trade result in the most costly approach to achieving greenhouse gas reductions. One of the first things that I learned on the cap and trade work group was that the primary purpose of a cap and trade program is to reduce the cost of greenhouse gas compliance through a robust trading mechanism. This bill, however, requires all of the most costly approaches to a cap and trade proposal. First of all, it requires 100% auction of allowances on day one of the program. In other words, with a 100% auction approach, there will actually be very little trading. They'll mostly just be buying allowances from the auctioneer. Secondly, it allows for no offsets from other areas and provides for no safety valve if the allowance prices go too high. So it appears that the primary purpose of this bill is not to reduce compliance costs, but simply is to raise revenues. For CenterPoint Energy, we estimate that this bill will cost our customers between $70 and $140 million per year in 2015, and that number will rise to $150 to over $300 million per year in 2025. These costs will be passed on to our customers just like a tax. The average residential customer would pay $50 to $100 per year in 2015, and this amount would double to $100 to $200 per year in 2025. For the state as a whole, and Mr. Robertson has mentioned this already, but the MCAG independent consultant projected that an auction approach for Minnesota would cost $5 billion per year in 2025. This is an amount that could seriously harm the Minnesota economy. The second point I wanted to make is that the proposed principles in the bill are unfair to companies that are trying to comply with the 2007 greenhouse gas requirements. Last year, as has been mentioned, the legislature passed Chapter 216H, requiring greenhouse gas emission reductions of 15% by 2015, 30% by 2025, and 80% by 2050. Now, obviously, this was very aggressive, yet it was a phased-in approach to addressing the climate change issue. The legislature knew it would not be possible to go from no regulation of carbon to 100% regulation of carbon all at once. The auction requirement in this bill is inconsistent with this approach. In fact, I believe that an auction approach is inconsistent with any existing type of environmental regulation in Minnesota. I'd like to briefly go through an example. Even if a company spends millions of dollars to achieve compliance with the greenhouse gas reduction targets, the auction requirement would still force that company to buy additional allowances at a potential cost of millions of dollars more. It is simply unfair to require companies that are in compliance with the greenhouse gas targets to pay for additional allowances. My third and last point is that, and this one has been addressed a little bit before, but this cap-and-trade bill is premature, we believe, at this time. The bill acknowledges that there are many important questions to be answered and requires a study on those questions in Section 6, Subdivision 4. We agree that more work is needed on several of these questions, such as what will the allowance prices be? What will the increases in energy prices be? What is the impact of various greenhouse gas reduction activities? And what industries will be put at a competitive disadvantage? Quite frankly, these questions need to be answered before passing a law that includes principles on cap and trade. In fact, the last question on competitive disadvantage for industries, we believe, is especially important. If Minnesota mandates 100% auction as proposed in this bill before the regional process is even started, other states, such as Wisconsin or Iowa, could use that to their competitive advantage. For example, they could say, if Minnesota is 100% auction, let's adopt a 20% auction approach and encourage businesses to move to our state with lower compliance costs. The MCAG Cap and Trade Work Group worked on these issues for several months and finally recommended that more study was needed, especially on several hybrid approaches that contain a combination of allocation and auction approaches. Example of these hybrids have already been mentioned by Mr. Robertson, but I'd like to reiterate just three of them. First, a partial auction, partial allocation. Secondly, a shift from allocation to auction over time. And third, an auction for unregulated companies and an allocation for regulated companies, such as regulated utilities. And we think that one bears looking at because as a regulated utility, there's no opportunity for us to ever have windfall profits. If we are ever able to sell some allowances at a profit, we know that our state regulators would require us to give those excess revenues back to our customers. So there's no opportunity for windfall for us. We agree with the MCAG that more study is needed on these complex issues. In conclusion, the proposed principles in this bill are excessively costly and could seriously damage Minnesota's economy. There is also no pressing need to decide these program design issues now before several important questions can be answered. We urge you to follow the MCAG cap-and-trade recommendation to continue to study all the various cap-and-trade approaches and to not mandate the most costly approach at this time. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, this is just a question for the chair. Some of us have committee meetings that have started at 3 o'clock. Do you anticipate this going on, and are you going to have a vote on this today? Or
this is not going to go on much longer. We are going to have a vote today.
Because I know some other members have left.
Yeah.
And here's what I'd as long as you bring up the question, Senator, let me just first of all mention, I think the point on the auctions has been made. And I, as chair, am willing to stipulate, and I think a lot of committee members would as well, that there is concern about the auction portion of this bill. So I don't think that needs to bear any more repetition. I think that'll help speed along the testimony as well. What we need to do in this committee is figure out whether a cap-and-trade program is beneficial or not beneficial for Minnesota, whether it be state, regional, or federal. And I would appreciate if maybe we could kind of stick to that point. If there are additional points on the auction program or other components of Senator Anderson's bill that there are concerned that has not been mentioned, please do so. But I think we've made the point on the auction, and to be honest, that's not a decision this committee is going to make. We're not going to decide what type of mechanism is going to be made in this program. The Energy Policy Committee is going to make that decision. And there's going to be a stakeholder meeting on Friday to discuss that further. And there will be another full hearing on this issue, including the particulars of this, of the cap and trade program. But our committee needs to figure out whether a cap and trade program is good environmental policy or bad environmental policy. Welcome to the committee. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. I think I just cut my testimony real short. Thank you. I'm Lee Sundberg. I'm with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. We represent the 44 nonprofit member-owned distribution co-ops and the six G&Ts. And because of our size in the area that we serve, we are concerned with the not just the environmental and reliability aspects, but with the cost. So instead of putting this in terms of billions of dollars, for the state and the environmental impacts, wanted to bring it down just a level, a bit to the focus on our consumers, and we figured at $35 a ton. In a cap and trade program, the impact for a typical residential co-op customer would be about $450 annually, which would be about a 40% increase. And add that along the cumulative effect of that with, on the what you've already done, good acts that were passed last year. We're talking about 55% increases. So with those kind of impacts, we are obviously. Want to help be involved in the stakeholder group and ensure a reasonable and workable CO2 emissions program, and we'll be glad to work with Senator Anderson and others on that.
The cost that you mentioned, was that under a state, regional, or federal cap and trade program?
Any of the programs, regardless of the source. It, at $35 a ton, which is a reasonable estimate at this point, not using the $46 that the MCAG used, but we think 10 or 20 is probably pretty low.
And so, any mechanism in any form would create that cost?
Any type of credit trading scheme, yes.
And council follow up, as long as there's an auction, is that what you mean? Or is that
in any, well, the in
auction or not, you say that that would
trading.
Cost that much?
Okay. Whether it was part of an auction or there could be trading after the allowance.
Okay. Given. All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Oh, good afternoon, Chairman Chaudhry and members of the committee. My name is Michael Cashin. I am Senior Environmental Policy Advisor for Minnesota Power. In context of the shortened agenda or focus you'd like to give, I'm going to just make a few points for Minnesota Power. I've been involved with the CCAG process and the energy supply and the cap and trade working groups. And I just like to affirm that in that process, we had a lot of good discussion with stakeholders. In the process of whittling down that list of 300 options and focusing on that 55 options, we found that there was a need to prioritize there, just as you might expect there would be in any other process. We did prioritize. We focused on those measures that we thought would bring the most benefit and relatively lowest cost. And some of the harder issues that we were facing that we could see needed more study, we really did not delve into. That would include the cap and trade alternatives for allowance allocations, the various measures to bring down cost. There are a lot of interests that have different angles on how to approach that, and we recognize that in the process we would focus on options for reductions and bringing those forward and those other measures we recommended for further study. So with that perspective, I would encourage that the provisions as they're proposed in legislation here also be considered for further study, because they delve into the very same subject matter that we thought was going to be a challenge and not workable for the time constraint we had there. That said, Minnesota Power has been involved with voluntary climate action. There was a question asked about that previously. As you might recall, in earlier years, that was an important focus. And through our measures, we figured we have now offset or avoided emissions of about 10% of our base. But if you consider 10% relative to the more aggressive goals that we're talking about here, 30% by 2025, there are challenges that we need to go along and would put voluntary measures a challenge. You get into a situation where voluntary needs to have focus. So from that perspective, I just wanted to emphasize that when it comes to working with something like cap and trade or any mechanism like this, that you can figure that there's three categories of cost surrounding meeting your environmental objective. And the first category would reflect those measures that we're already experiencing in Minnesota. For example, the performance targets, the efficiency standards, those things that were laid out with mandates or regulations that we would need to do, appliance standards, all of these types of things bring greenhouse gas benefits. They've been studied, their costs have been understood, and they're in the application. And when we did the CCAG process, we found that those measures did bring quite a lot of benefit for the overall projection for Minnesota emissions. But in order to bring emissions in line with the legislative targets, we also recognize that there's going to be a need to exercise those other 55 measures. And that would be what I'd call the second category, which are those measures that we need to do that actually bring on greenhouse gas emissions to meet the targets. A lot of these things were identified as they could bring cost savings as well as cost to consumers, because you might avoid the cost of a more expensive alternative. And the CCAG report is in the process even now of working out some of that analysis. But all things said, it's the items in the category of category one that I was describing about the standards and the mandates that have been established, plus these new measures that are in formation that bring down greenhouse gas emissions. And then the third category would be those measures that policymakers would decide to impose cost on the leftovers, the residual emissions that occur after we've met our policy objectives. And I think people that have spoken before me have brought out several different reasons as to why this isn't desirable. But under previous cap and trade programs that we've had experience with at the utility industry, we benefited from a zero cost base allocation. So we would have benefit that once we met the target and we implemented the reductions to meet the standard, we didn't have to deal with an additional cost component for those residual emissions that policymakers considered acceptable or tolerable when we were done. And in practice, because when you're doing the category one or two activities, you're basically working up the cost curve and doing all of the low-hanging fruit, the cheaper cost reductions, up to the point where you limit out and you reach your objective. Going anything further would cost more per ton. So in a practical sense, this third category of assigning cost to those emissions that are left over after you met your target is just a reflection of an inefficiency in policy. So you could call it 100% auction. You could call it a carbon tax. You could assign, you know, lots of different approaches to putting cost on that third category. But from Minnesota Power's perspective, we think that before any policy goes forward and would attempt to put a cost on that third category, that it should be studied very carefully for how it would impact jobs in Minnesota, electric prices, and so forth. As it currently stands right now, we fully expect that the cost for climate action is going to be expensive, and we would certainly want to see measures that are implemented show an environmental benefit and trade-offs for the benefit of our customers.
Thank you. Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I note that there are some sectors missing from today's witness list, and I know that there is a sector here that's included in both Sections 2 and 3 in the bill that we haven't heard from, and I think it's important that we extend that right to them to speak now. That would be Flint Hills.
Senator Parasol, in addition to the printed agenda, I also have Wayne Brandt from the Forest Industries, Diane Schmidt from Flint Hills, and Annette Henkel from the Minnesota Utility Investors. So we will hear from them.
Thank you. I want to make sure we would hear from all the sectors that are already included.
Yep. Okay. Wayne Brandt, Diane Schmidt, Annette Henkel.
Wayne Brandt.
Okay.
I know.
Ms. Henkel, Annette Henkel, why don't you come up too? Mr. Pagel, you want to speak for the forest industries?
Well, I'd like to take his place and not speak on behalf of the forest industries, but for the Iron Mining Association and the iron mines. Okay. I thought I'd been placed on the list as well.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll be very, very brief. A lot has been said about the cap and trade. What I would like to go to is Section 3, Subdivision 2. Basically, what this section does is tells which sectors are required to make the cap and trade reductions in goals, as well as by the allocations. As written, the large industries would not only have to, one, pay for the utility costs for the auctions and efforts to reduce greenhouse gases that the utilities are making, we would, two, also be required to reduce greenhouse gases from the same energy we're purchasing that already has allocations on it or is being reduced from the utilities, which creates a doubling of reductions. Everyone's always worried about a doubling of counting of reductions. This is going to make us actually reduce twice on the same energy. And three, at the same time, we have to pay for our own greenhouse gas auctions as well as attempt to make reductions. The bill does not allow for aggregation of efforts, which in fact could reduce greenhouse gases, whether it's in the sector or outside of the trading sector. I'd be happy to give examples of that if the committee would like. But in effect, you could shift where iron ore, taconite pellets is produced to another country, say China or India, where the greenhouse gas emissions are 42% higher for the same ton of steel that's produced.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Diane Schmidt, and I'm here today representing Flint Hills Resources. I put together testimony, so I won't hit all of it, and I'll just hit the portions that I think are important for the committee to know and that are somewhat different. First and foremost, Flint Hills is a refinery in Rosemount, and we produce about 50% of the gasoline, diesel fuel, and about 80 to 90% of the jet fuel in the state. You can read a lot of the rest of our statistics, but I think what's important to know is about the Department of Trade and Economic Development has indicated that about 8,200 jobs statewide and about $350 million worth of payroll is attributable to this particular facility. And so it's an important economic asset for the state. Rather than going into some of the economic impacts in here, I want to hit why this bill is different and why it would affect us differently and why we're sort of new coming to this type of legislation. As far as we understand, there is no other region or system that has been set up that includes the transportation and refining industry. So this particular legislation, as you're moving to a larger group of folks that are included in that sector, will bring in gasoline. And I want to make sure I put on the record that a company like ours, who does not have a lot of additional technology options, would immediately have to start buying credits as a result of this type of cap-and-trade program. As a result, gasoline prices will go up. Prices will go up because we will be required to buy credits, and those costs will be passed along to the public. And I wanted to make sure I got that on the record because there hasn't been a lot of discussion from our industry and because this is the first time in legislation in Minnesota we've been included, I thought it was important that we get that testimony on the record and that you understand that not only from an economic standpoint is it important, but also from an environmental standpoint, you should know a couple of things in the bill. First of all, there's a major conflict between federal and state law from an environmental standpoint when it comes to counting our emissions at our facility. The federal government required us to undertake operations to reduce the sulfur in our ultra-low sulfur diesel, which is good for the environment. But what it did was automatically increase our CO2 emissions. So you're having the federal government require us, and we made a several hundred million dollar expansion to make that happen, which is good for the fuel, but now we are significantly increasing our CO2. So not only in this legislation would our particular facility fall under the CO2 and the cap-and-trade requirements, but also the way the bill is drafted, we would have to buy credits at our facility to cover all of the emissions off the tailpipe. To do that would mean that we would have to be buying substantial amounts of credit that we have not been contemplated before. And the only way for us to be able to stay in business and continue to provide the products that we do in Minnesota is that those costs would have to be passed along. So I wanted to make sure that I at least highlighted that point because I don't think our sector of the industry has been up to talk to your committee about this before. Certainly there's a lot of additional information in my testimony, but I wanted to make sure that I at least made that point, and you have the testimony to read.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Henkel, and thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair, and I will be very brief. My name, for the record, is Annette Henkel, and I'm with the Minnesota Utility Investors. Most of you know who our members are. Our members are older, retired people. They've invested in Minnesota's investor-owned utilities, because a lot of them consider them the widow and orphan stock. They rely upon the dividend that these companies provide for their livelihood when living on fixed income in their retirement. Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, I do appreciate just the opportunity. As Senator Anderson said, we understand that this train has left the station. We recognize that there is going to be a cap-and-trade program. We strongly encourage you, the legislature, to pursue the economic and emission studies first so the legislature is informed about the decisions, the costs that this kind of program will have on their constituents, our members. So we would strongly encourage you to do that first before you start putting parameters about what this program would look like. When our members see headlines in, I think it was the Wall Street Journal yesterday, Moody's raises caution over how climate rules will affect utilities. Moody's, the credit rating agency that dictates a lot of what the companies that our members have invested in and how they are able to move forward. They quote, "The resulting increase in electricity prices may make recovery of other operating costs and capital investments like transmission to build lines for transmission for wind, for the mercury reduction programs, for those kind of things that make that more challenging. Such a scenario could cause negative ratings actions within the sector." So that's our only point. That's our concern from our perspective. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Here's my observation, and then I'll let Senator Anderson have the last word unless there are other comments. First of all, this has been a really good hearing. I learned a lot about cap-and-trade program, and frankly, I really didn't know anything about it except for the name beforehand. And so this has helped clarify a lot of benefits and concerns about it. My second observation is that there's general, not 100%, but there seems to be general consensus that a cap-and-trade program would be beneficial to the environment. Most of the industry, from what I heard, preferred a federal cap-and-trade. Regional, second choice, but not a state. The third observation I'd make is that Senator Anderson's bill does not create a state cap-and-trade program. And I think that's one thing that was cleared up for me. I thought that's what it did beforehand. And so what you're seeking to do is to set a certain minimum standard for when the governor negotiates a regional cap and trade program. And the last observation is that there is a certain concern over some of these minimum standards that you have in the bill. But you know, in my opinion, what we need to do today is, as an environment policy committee, is figure out whether a cap and trade program is good environmental policy. And I'm hearing generally that it is generally good environment policy, but there is significant difference on how it should be implemented. And that, to me, is a discussion that the Energy Policy Committee should have. Others are welcome to speak, but I think that we have enough here to pass it out of this committee to Senator Prettner-Solon's Environment Policy Committee, where there will be another full hearing, and I imagine they will get into the auction and other issues in far more detail. And most importantly, there will be continued to be discussions with all the stakeholders on this issue. And as Senator Anderson mentioned, and I just received a note recently, so if you haven't gotten an email or a call yet, that's because it just happened about a half an hour ago. There will be a meeting about this bill on Friday morning at 8 a.m. in this room with a stakeholder meeting called by Senator Prettner-Solon, so that and Senator Anderson is aware of this and is supportive of this stakeholder meeting and process. So it's my feeling that it's okay to keep this discussion going, I would support a motion to pass this out.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a quick amendment.
Okay.
And it's not, I don't think any of it is substantive. One of them might be that on page 2, line 24.
Go ahead.
Delete add and insert recommend. The way this word, the commissioner could just on the own commissioner's volition without any hearings or anything, add. I don't think we want that. So they recommend the legislature. Page 3, line 11. Delete such.
How did we kiss every one of them?
Page 3, line 14. Delete strongly encouraged and insert authorized. And
I didn't get that one.
Page 3, line 14.
Thank you.
Delete strongly encouraged and insert authorized. In the same line, delete work and insert enter into agreements. On page 19, page 3, excuse me, page 3, line 19, delete everything after the paren, b paren, delete line 20, delete line 21, and insert any agreements negotiated must be enacted into law before the agreements become effective.
Mr. Chair, let me just make sure I understand the last one. You're deleting lines 3.19, 20, and 21 and replacing them with your sentence, any agreements negotiated are not effective until enacted into law or something?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, that's essentially
okay.
Right.
All right. Mr. Chair, I think those are very good suggestions, and I would accept those.
On the Frederickson motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Anderson, do you have a motion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
You have last word.
Yeah, and I'll.
As the author.
I don't want to take time to respond to testimony. We don't have time for that, and I appreciate everyone's patience. Senator Vickerman had an amendment that I promised I'll offer in the next committee that expands forestry practice possibilities, incentives for that. And just want to state again, I'm committed to working out some of these differences. Obviously, there's a lot that we have to discuss, and I think this was an excellent start. I heard a lot of common ground that I think is possible for us to move forward with. And I could say a lot, but I think I'll save my speeches for the next opportunity, because I don't want to try anyone's patience. senators have to leave. So I'd like to move the bill forward and ask the committee to move the bill to the next committee, and with my commitment to continue to work on compromises.
Senator Anderson moves that Senate file 2818 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Energy Policy. Senator Stump.
As amended.
Oh, okay. We have an amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to divide that motion and divide out Subdivision 4, Section 6, Subdivision 4. And my rationale is that I heard an awful lot about costs, and I don't know about you, but we've gotten word from our electric co-ops that we're getting an increase this year, we're getting an increase next year. I think there's 6% increase this year, 9% next year. And here we're talking about billions of dollars being transferred over to the consumers. And it really is a pass-through. I mean, it's not businesses don't stay in business. They pass that extra cost on to their consumers. So I think it would be wise for us to have some kind of an economic study of what this all entails. And I feel that part of it could move forward, so I would ask that we'd vote on that Subdivision 4 first, and then the other part, the rest of it, second.
Mr. Chair.
Could Council just clarify the amendment, what we're voting on?
Well, Mr. Chair, just as a matter of procedure, I don't know if it's proper to move part of a bill separately. I mean, that's a little unusual. Because what would the next motion be, to move another part of the bill? I don't really know how we can do that.
I'm just dividing your motion.
Okay. We usually divide amendments, but either council, maybe you could advise us.
Mr. Chairman, it's not my understanding that you can divide a motion to move a bill forward, our portion of the bill. I think the motion should be to amend the bill to reflect the motion that you want to have.
Okay.
And for the bill to be in the shape that you want to have to move forward.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Chair.
I'm not aware anyways. I've not been part of a committee that has done.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if Senator Stumpf would consider changing it to a motion to move without recommendation from this committee. So at least we could have the elements here to have the legislative voice that we're talking about not removed from the bill before it goes to the next step. You know, we're going to be discussing the details, the particulars of that, but I think if you take out the whole premise that the legislature should establish some principles, you know, there's not much left to the bill. So I don't know which would take precedence, but I would propose amending my motion to move the bill without recommendation to the next committee and see if that would help.
I think as a courtesy to Senator Stumpf, I'm going to let him modify his motion to do it the way he wants, and then we'll vote on that. And then if you want to change your withdraw your current motion and move another one that, as you described, we could do that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, then what I would move would be to
Mr. Chairman, if you want some help, I can help.
Senator Stumpf, the council can help you. I think he knows what you want.
Mr. Chairman, if you're looking at just having the economic and emissions study be a portion, be the bill, basically, you want to delete everything else in the bill,
Mr. Chairman and council, here's what I'd like. I think Section 6, Subdivision 4. So Section 4 and Section 6, Subdivision 4.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then I think your motion, Senator Stumpf, would be to delete Section 1, delete Section 2, Section 3, and then delete from Section 6, Subdivisions 1, 2, and 3, And then I think in the appropriations section, you'd want to delete paragraph A, and then the remainder of the bill would stay.
Okay.
The bill would then be section 4, directing the commissioner or directing the governor on the or authorizing the governor on the greenhouse gas accord, and it would include the economic emission study and the money for that study.
Okay. That would be my motion.
Okay, discussion.
Well, Mr. Chair, obviously I'd oppose that motion. I'd ask members to at least give me the courtesy to bring the bill to the next step and continue the discussion and see what we can come up with, see if we can find a consensus. We haven't really had an opportunity to do that yet. And so I think I'll just leave it at that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
The amendment I had has to do with agriculture, and I think we need a little more time. I'm supposed to be voting on judges here in about 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. Senator Stump, I share the concerns you do, but I think we can find a compromise in here some way. And to kill your bill, I just can't do that. Okay. I've never done that, and I'm not going to do that. But I sympathize with you because I know where you're coming from. Is there some way we can? We've had so much turmoil the last couple of days and getting pretty sick of it. Can't we get together with some kind of a compromise? I'm just asking.
Mr. Chairman, here's the problem I have, and I think others have it too, and obviously is that we have some major pieces of legislation, whether we're adopting California standards under Senator Marty's legislation, we're initiating a cap-and-trade program that probably would be best done at the national level or regional level, but here we are at a state level. I mean, some huge issues that we started at 12:15, and here it's about going to be 4 o'clock. And some of us, as the chair, probably haven't had the opportunity to have that interaction with the issues. All I know is that when you talk about literally 20, 30, 40% increases in your electric rates, it's going to be a difficult challenge to tell consumers out there that this is something that's good for them. We all want to save, be good conservationists and save on energy and everything, but I think there's some definite movements there from the commissioner or the assistant commissioner of commerce talking about the accord and the study. I think those are two very, very strong components of the bill, and I don't. I realize the cap and trade part of it is what Senator Anderson feels that she needs, but I think that that would be a very positive step by this legislature if we did that, or did what the amendment does.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I just want to be really clear that this cap and trade, this regional cap and trade it's going to happen. I mean, it's moving forward. It's moving forward whether we do pass this bill or not. So the only real question is, do we want to participate in the discussion? Do we want to try to work out how it's going to affect us and answer those questions? Because if we don't pass the other part, or anything, then it's totally up to the governor and 6 other governors to decide our fate and bring that back to us and then say, here's what it should look like. And I'm just trying to say the legislature's job is to grapple with these are really hard questions, and we got to figure out how we can do this in a way that's good for our state. But that question is going to be presented to us one way or the other, and this is starting that discussion, and we need to have that discussion. And I think if you take these pieces out, the legislature is saying, we're not going to discuss it. We're just going to let the governor decide. Well, that's what I don't want to do.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I don't think if you don't have the legislation in here as presented, it's going to be part of the discussion anyway. I mean, I think the concern on the part of a lot of people is that we will outline and define what that narrow discussion, or narrow it so much that will have an undue effect on either the accord or prices. And so I'd like to leave that opportunity a little bit broader, a little bit wider than just, you know, forcing us down that road.
Senator Skogin, then let's vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with most of what Senator Stumpf says, and I would just caution that if we give the governor criteria, we may be an island when he goes to the regional. The others may say, we aren't doing that, and now we're alone. The other thing is, Mr. Chair said, you know, what this committee needs to decide is if we agree that cap and trade is where we want to go, or that it's a good thing. I would have to say that this is what we're moving forward, and I would have to say that cap and trade is not a good thing in this document. There's just too many things, too many red flags for me. So,
okay. Thank you. On the Stumpf motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment's not adopted.
Mr. Chair.
On the Anderson motion.
I would move that the bill, Senate file, whatever it is, 2818, be moved forward without recommendation to the Committee on Energy.
Senator Anderson withdraws her motion and moves that Senate file 2818.
As amended.
As amended.
As amended. Pass without recommendation, referred to the Energy Policy Committee. Everyone understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Aye.
Motion prevails.
Thank you,
members.
Mr. Chair.
And the meeting is adjourned.
I'm all here. Done.